Bowl. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! I guess it's officially winter, at least around here. Our roof survived the winds, but I am, as of this evening, no longer able, and probably not able until May, to do the show naked. Because, you know, that's how we do the program, naked. Yeah. But it's just way too cold in the studio here, and I don't want to run the power bill up, so we don't have any heat going yet. Just sort of warming myself off the heat coming from the computers. Yeah, that's it. So, I don't know. No naked radio until well past Groundhog Day. Don't even do the visual. It's not worth it. It's just awful. Just awful. It's Thursday. Some portion of me, for reasons I don't fully understand, thinks it's Friday, but it isn't. It's Thursday. So, we've got tonight and tomorrow night some fine conversation going on, I hope. And, you know, this is one of those nights that I'm glad I've got this show. Because I've just got to get some stuff out of my system, and I will do everything in my power not to scream too much. But there's plenty to be frustrated about. I don't know about you. I don't know if you watched the Nobel acceptance speech or have read the transcript. But you know what? there's a lot in that speech not to love. Our president does give good speech. He is so far removed from the stumblings and bumblings and oafish babblings of the moron, jug-eared, pig-eyed idiot who inhabited the White House for the last 8 years, that you at least have to respect that, I guess. But still, that speech. Sweet Jesus, that speech. I'm not going to read it all. But it involved a discussion of what just war is. But there were some lines that leaped out at me. But perhaps the most profound issue surrounding my receipt of this prize is the fact that I am the commander-in-chief of a nation in the midst of two wars. One of these wars is winding down. How's that winding down working out for you there, President Obama? Did you see the report of all the death and carnage from that bomb blast that went off yesterday? That's some winding down, all right. The other is a conflict that America did not seek, one in which we are joined by 43 other countries, including Norway, in an effort to defend ourselves and all nations from further attacks. No mention in there that both of them are wars of choice. You know, it was a week ago tonight, in fact, that Reverbo and I did the whole history thing, sort of going over why it is we're in Afghanistan and how Afghanistan came to be Afghanistan in our sort of little modern world. And no mention in that those were wars of choice that were forced upon the American people. And were not wars of necessity. You know, he goes on and he discusses this thing about just war, the concept of just war. And I don't know. I don't know if just war is something we need to be talking about in the 21st century. Perhaps we need to be talking about necessary war. Because there's no way that you can call Iraq or Afghanistan a war of necessity. They were wars of choice. These questions are not new. War, in one form or another, appeared with the first man. At the dawn of history, its morality was not questioned. It was simply a fact. Like drought or disease, the manner in which tribes and then civilizations sought power and settled their differences. Yeah, I know my Obama's not quite up to snuff yet. I'm still working on it. I'll have him down by the end of his term. His one term. Sweet Jesus, President Palin. Oh, God. And so he gives a little history lesson, with including, of course, the concept of just war. And then he talks about how nifty it is that we are the country, the world's sole superpower. And then says we must begin by acknowledging the hard truth that we will not eradicate violent conflict in our lifetimes. Well, no, we won't. Once you've decided that you won't, you ain't gonna. How's that? Are we square? And then he invokes the name of Dr. King. I make this statement mindful of what Martin Luther King said in this same ceremony years ago. Violence never brings permanent peace. It solves no social problem. It merely creates new and more complicated ones. As someone who stands here as a direct consequence of Dr. King's life's work, I am living testimony to the moral force of nonviolence. I know there is nothing weak, nothing passive, nothing naive in the creed and lives of Gandhi and King. But as head of state sworn to protect and defend my nation, time out. I think he's sworn to protect and defend the Constitution. Check me on that. I could be wrong, and it wouldn't be the first time, and it won't be the last. But check that oath for me. Isn't it protect and defend the Constitution of the United States? Make no mistake, evil does exist in the world. A nonviolent movement could not have halted Hitler's armies. Well, he also mentions the League of Nations, which was shot down by a bunch of punk-ass repiglickens in the latter part of the second and early part of the third decade of the 20th century. And that was geared toward nonviolence, geared toward making sure that World War I never became World War II. But again, bloody-handed, ham-fisted, thuggish repiglickens, they practically killed Woodrow Wilson to kill the treaty that would have created America's participation in the League of Nations. And yes, it might very well have prevented World War II nonviolently. And that was to be a nonviolent movement. So, negotiations cannot convince Al-Qaeda's leaders to lay down their arms. Okay. Which ones? Which of the 100 Al-Qaeda operatives that are still in Afghanistan aren't going to lay down their arms? Because that's what his own estimates say is in Afghanistan in the way of Al-Qaeda. 100. 100. Not 1,000. Not 10,000. Not 100,000. 100. 10 squared. 100. Yeah. It goes on and on and on. But there was this paragraph that rather leaped out at me because of what it reminded me of in ancient history. Oh, God, Marvelline, he's going to talk about that ancient history again. Damn. Is Dancing with Tiger Woods on yet?
To begin with, I believe that all nations, strong and weak alike, must adhere to standards that govern the use of force. I, like any head of state, reserve the right to act unilaterally. Oh, Jesus, it's the Bush Doctrine! Where did that come from?
I'm back.
I reserve the right to act unilaterally if necessary to defend my nation.
That's kind of new. At least in modern history, you know, post-World War II, that's kind of new. It's so new that it was given a new name back during those long, eight tortured, tormented years of the Bush administration. It was called the Bush Doctrine. We will kill anybody at any time, on any whim, any notion, anywhere that we see fit because we can.
And Barack Obama, in accepting the Nobel Peace Prize, cited the godforsaken Bush Doctrine. Honest to God, I thought breakfast was going to come up when I saw that. That was mighty hard to keep down. But that first sentence.
To begin with, I believe that all nations, strong and weak alike, must adhere to standards that govern the use of force.
There is a line in Thucydides, I do believe, in the Peloponnesian War. It is called the Melian Dialogue. And there is a line from the Melian Dialogue that says, and I am paraphrasing, do not quote me, great nations do as they wish. Lesser nations do as they must. Because, you see, the Athenians offered the same sort of terms to the Melians that the Bush administration offered to Afghanistan. Remember that? You can have a carpet of gold or a carpet of bombs. The Athenians said to the Melians, if it was the Melians, or maybe that's where the dialogue took place, I'm a little iffy on that, you'll have to help me. But the Athenians said, hey, go along with us and everything's going to be great, but, you know, if you try to be neutral or in anything like that, we're going to destroy you. And the response came, what kind of a bargain is that? And arising out of that is the statement, great nations do as they wish. Lesser nations do as they must. So that business about all nations strong and weak alike adhering to standards that govern the use of force is pure unmitigated bull. Because there is no restraint upon the United States of America that makes us behave in either a moral or even a legal fashion when engaging the use of force. There is not a force upon the planet that can stop us and can stop those glorified video game operators from firing more hellfire missiles from Predator drones into more Afghan wedding parties. Although I imagine, given the season of the year, that will probably go down some because it's getting badass cold over there, too. No more naked radio for them, either. No one can stop us. And no one will. And in the midst of all this palaver about the nations strong and weak alike adhering to standards that govern the use of force, let me offer you this. I have a list for you. That list is Bahrain, Burma, also known as Myanmar, Communist China, Iran, Libya, Morocco, North Korea, Oman, Saudi Arabia, Somalia, the United Arab Emirates, and Uzbekistan. That's a whole bunch of places I don't want to go, Alex? Oh, too bad, because there's one more on the list. The United States of America. So let's go over that list again. Bahrain, Burma, China, Iran, Libya, Morocco, North Korea, Oman, Saudi Arabia, Somalia, the United Arab Emirates, the United States of America, and Uzbekistan. Man, that's some fine company to be in. What would that list comprise? Why would we be on a list with those countries? Why would we be? Especially in light of the fact that all nations, strong and weak alike, must adhere to standards that govern the use of force. Why would we be on that list? Granted, with regard to everything but the every other nation but the United States on that list, those are a bunch of really brutal, corrupt, authoritarian, murderous, miserable countries. But they're also something else. They are also the only countries that continue to reject the International Convention banning landmines. And we're in that group, too. Hold on. I reserve the right to act unilaterally, if necessary, to defend my nation. Nevertheless, I am convinced that adhering to standards strengthens those who do and isolates and weakens those who don't. Does that mean we're isolated and weakened now because of... No. Why was it that we couldn't... Why is it that we couldn't join that convention? Oh, by the way, Israel refused to join that convention as well. There we go. Well, we can't do it. And this is the quote from State Department spokesperson Ian Kelly. We can't do it because, and here we're quoting, we would not be able to meet our national defense needs nor our security commitments to our friends and allies if we sign this convention. Really? And which friends and allies would that be? Bahrain, Burma, China, Iran, Libya, Morocco, North Korea, Oman, Saudi Arabia, Somalia, the United Arab Emirates, and Uzbekistan? Because I don't see the United Kingdom on that list. I don't see France. I don't see Norway or Sweden or Finland or Denmark or Germany or Poland or the Czech Republic or Italy, Greece, Spain, Portugal. Any of our NATO allies, Turkey? Turkey's not even on that list. But we can't maintain our commitments to them, like through NATO, unless we leave landmines in the ground that disfigure years and years and perhaps decades later, little children doing no more than trying to play maybe soccer? No, we can't do that because we wouldn't be able to meet our national defense needs. What kind of weak and pusillanimous nation has national defense needs that involve leaving explosives in the ground that destroy children and mothers and peasants and farmers? And the least among us, what kind of mighty nation has that kind of defense needs? But that's okay. That's okay. Because Barack Obama said today, America cannot insist that others follow the rules of the road if we refuse to follow them ourselves. For when we don't, our action can appear arbitrary and undercut the legitimacy of future intervention, no matter how justified. Hypocrisy much? Yeah, this thing went on and on and on. There's reference to Nixon going to China and meeting with Mao. And you know, I'll tell you, that was not the, when I read the speech, that was not the part that reminded me of the landmines business, because I've had that sitting in the stack for a couple of days, just waiting for karma to sort of make it all fit. No, it was this passage.
It is undoubtedly true that development rarely takes root without security. It is also true that security does not exist where human beings do not have access to enough food or clean water or the medicine they need to survive. It does not exist where children cannot aspire to a decent education or a job that supports a family. The absence of hope can rot a society from within.
That must be that feeling I've been feeling during the whole healthcare debate, that absence of hope rotting me from within. But then he goes on.
And that is why helping farmers feed their own people or nations educate their children and care for the sick is not mere charity. It is also why the world must come together to confront climate change.
How's that farmer going to feed his own family when he wanders over an old American landmine and blows his leg off up to just above the kneecap? I mean, it's gonna be a little hard to stand behind the oxen or the mule or the donkey or the whatever, with your plow and gee and haw that thing up and down to get the, you know, to get the crops in the ground when, you know, oh, I don't know, maybe he can hold onto the two handles of the plowshares and just hop. Oh yeah, this goes on and on and on. He invokes Aung San Suu Kyi, Zimbabwe, and somewhere in here there's some line about, there it is.
Where force is necessary, we have a moral and strategic interest in binding ourselves to certain rules of conduct. And even as we confront a vicious adversary that abides by no rules, I believe that the United States,
all 100 of them,
I believe that the United States of America must remain a standard bearer in the conduct of war. That is what makes us different from those whom we fight. That is a source of our strength. That is why I prohibited torture.
Time out. Other story. Okie dokie, other story. Got another story here. Hold on. There it is. Yeah. From over at Raw Story via Jonathan Turley. Or Jonathan Turley via Raw Story, probably, more properly. The Obama administration has asked the Department of Justice to dismiss a lawsuit brought by convicted terrorist Jose Padilla against torture memo author John Yoo, asserting that Yoo cannot be sued for legal opinions he offered in the course of advising then-President Bush on national security matters. Constitutional law professor Jonathan Turley finds this decision inexplicable. Quote, the president literally has gotten onto a plane this evening to go to Norway, he told MSNBC's Keith Olbermann on Wednesday, to accept the Nobel Prize while his Justice Department is effectively gutting a major part of Nuremberg. He continued, the Obama administration is arguing not only that they shouldn't be prosecuted, but it's now saying that you shouldn't even be able to sue them civilly. And that's not to be missed. That's kind of important. Not only can they not be prosecuted for being war criminals, you can't even sue them. And for money damages. Nobody goes to jail. Mr. Turley added, it's an international disgrace. There is no limiting principle here, he said. John Yoo was essential to this torture program. If John Yoo cannot be sued for an alleged war crime, what possibly could a justice official be sued for? We're talking about the most extreme case. If you want to go over to Raw Story, there's video of it too, and you can hear Jonathan Turley say it for himself. So there we are. I'm just... landmines, torture, And so, of course, what do we do? Why, we're not even halfway through the speech and we got to do some saber rattling, sunshine.
It is also incumbent upon all of us to insist that nations like Iran and North Korea do not game the system. Those who claim to respect international law cannot avert their eyes when those laws are flouted.
Ah, President Obama, I really wish you hadn't done went and said that. Because we're the ones flouting international law. We're the ones that spat on the Geneva Convention. We're the ones who have built, for God's sakes, a concentration camp. You know, I got to tell you, watching the speech, I was a little embarrassed. Because it kept looking like, do as I say and not as I do.
I mean, listen to this one. This brings me to a second point, the nature of the peace that we seek. For peace is not merely the absence of visible conflict. Only a just peace, based upon the inherent rights and dignity of every individual, can truly be lasting. It was this insight that drove the drafters of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights after the Second World War. In the wake of devastation, they recognized that if human rights are not protected, peace is a hollow promise.
Now, I heard that, and I got sidetracked because I've been working on other things today. You know my life. But are we signatories to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights? There was just some little, kind of like a scratch in the back of your throat, that tickle in the back of your throat that you can't get to and just kind of makes you just miserable. Well, wait a minute, I don't think we're part of that. Or maybe we're not part of the amendments to it. Because I know for a fact that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights includes an absolute right of workers to form collective bargaining units, otherwise known as unions, and we ain't there. They're just saying. Oh, and there's globalization palaver. There's talk about faith. Gandhi and King get dragged out and flogged around a little bit more. And I just came away embarrassed. No, I'm no wingnut. The wingnuts are having an absolute hissy. The Caribou Barbie was out there saying, and I quote, "Yeah, I liked what he said. I talked, too, in my book about the fallen nature of man and why war is necessary at times. War is the last thing I believe any American wants to engage in, but it's necessary. We have to stop these terrorists."
Yeah, really. She basically accused Barack Obama of lifting his speech from going rouge.
And by the way, I'd like to see President Obama follow more closely in the footsteps of George Bush and his passion for keeping the homeland safe.
Yeah, we'll get to her her thoughts on perhaps debating Al Gore later. That'll be, I don't know, the humor part of the program. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Sandra.
Oh, man.
Screaming yet?
No, I just have to, you know, I wasn't even going to call in, but I just had to touch base on that, you know, that we are in the Orwellian world for sure. You know what? I couldn't even believe that he brought out King and leave them out your mouth, too. You know what I'm saying? Especially on that platform. I mean, how ridiculous. You said you walked away embarrassed. Yeah, oh my God, this is absurd. This man is talking about a just war? There is no such thing as a just war. That's just a load. Even the World War II was tragic. I wouldn't call it just.
No, and that's why I kind of draw that distinction between so-called just war as opposed to necessary war.
No, you know, necessary is when somebody up at your house, you know, about to take you and yours.
That's what I mean.
And not, no, this, for him to even try to say anything about any of the wars we're involved in as being just is just an insult to anybody who thinks and feels. Because, you know, the thing that's really interesting about it is that you notice how he kind of tried to keep it as low-key as possible. He's not hanging around because it's embarrassing.
It is.
There's no way that you can rationalize any of it. And the people, whoever on the committee, you know, they must be squirming at this point. I mean, it's a bit beyond the beyond now. And I don't, you know, I can't believe he was up there trying to talk about how we, the United States, is uniquely suited to what? Kill people around the world?
Killing for Jesus or something. I don't know. I mean, for God's sake, Sandra, he invoked the Bush Doctrine.
Yeah, but no, he's been doing that anytime he's dealing with issues of war, he's invoking that freak. So, like I said, when Bush was in power, the presidency is an animal that wants to expand, and any power it gets will not be returned. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, yes.
All these freaks who wanted, was hoping, oh, when he gets in, it's like, no, fool, when he gets in, he's going to embrace the expanded power just like anybody else who goes into that office. That's the problem with our system.
And that's and there's nothing new in that. I mean, that goes back to Jefferson.
Well, it goes back to, Washington. You know what I'm saying? It's like he formed the personality of the presidency, and we were lucky for a minute with him because in the big scheme of things, you know, he had some idea about the awesomeness of it. But then we drifted into Adams. Don't tell me that Adams wasn't an MF-er, okay? All right?
Yep.
No, I can't hear it. I mean, the president.
Right, and Jefferson is Adams's vice president, and Jefferson, because that was back before we fixed that Constitution where number two became vice president. And Jefferson spent those 4 years actively working against everything Adams did, and of course there was a lot to work against, especially things like the Alien and Sedition Act, you know, the earliest manifestation of proto-fascism in the history of the United States.
Exactly, and then Jefferson turned around and bought half the world.
Yeah, that there was no authority to do in the Constitution.
No, exactly. So, you know, the presidency is at the mercy of the people in power. I mean, Hamilton wanted something energetic. Good Lord. You know?
Oh, I know.
And it's just sort of, you know, the energetic presidency, it all sounds good on paper. And, you know, he was a damn royalist, so he tempered his real views, Hamilton. And we were propagandizing in the Federalist paper. So, you know, let's be honest about what we got. And so when these people are sitting around thinking that one character, Obama, is going to come in and roll back power, what planet?
Yeah, not happening.
You know,
and the fact of the matter is, this goes back a couple of days. But we now know. Never mind what got said in that really good speech about Afghanistan. I saw a thing yesterday where the Afghan government saying, "Well, you know, we're gonna need your military help for 15 or 20 years."
Yeah, no.
Basically Hamid Karzai saying, "I want the military here saving my dead ass until my dead ass is dead, of natural causes." Right? I mean, isn't that what it boils down to?
Well, yeah, and he's just such a cretin, that, that guy. But then again, he was a lobbyist for Uniroyal, Unocal, one of them god-awful energy conglomerates. So, you know, look at the source. But, you know, I'm kind of getting tired of the progressives sort of wringing their hands about what they got. It's just like, you know what? Read your history. You know, look at our government structure. You know, if you want to take yourself out of the partisan politics and just look at what we got, you know? And we don't even have what France has, which is a semi-presidential system where at least you can directly vote for the fool. We can't even do that here.
Nope. That electoral college is... You know, I keep looking for the admissions packet for the electoral college, and I can't seem to get in.
Just like I'm still there for my OJ prize. Exactly.
Right. But, you know, we talk about the Constitution in these hallowed terms, and I can get all weepy and misty-eyed over it, but who can't? But then you turn around and you realize that the entire history of this country is one person or another at some time or another throughout our history saying, Constitution, schmonstitution, I'm going to do what I damn well please. Where in the Constitution did it empower Andrew Jackson to commit genocide?
Well, No, exactly, you know, and in fact, you know, where did it empower him to expand the franchise for voting? You know, it's like they know what time it is. He says, oh, it's getting a bit uptight here. We better let some old poor white men vote and give them some land. You know what I mean? It's
40 acres and a mule, baby.
Well, they always frame it as if there's some sort of, you know, egalitarian aim to whatever new rights were involved in this country. But what it is that somebody's about to get their head stomped, and they have to give it up a little bit. That's how power is taken. I'm sick of it. The, you know, these people at their computers, they need to back off and get the hell out in the street. You know, if they really want something changed. You know, there's no different now with the internet. You know, the social movement still happen the same way, you know?
Well, yeah, you're right. And just to come forward a little bit, remember, Abraham Lincoln had no presidential authority to levy an entire army.
No.
But he did anyway.
Right.
And you know, when you go to a Civil War battlefield and you see all those monuments to Wisconsin and Iowa and Minnesota and Illinois and Indiana, and you're thinking, what in God's name did they have to do with somebody firing on somebody at Fort Sumter? Well, what they had to do with it was Abraham Lincoln said, I ain't got much of an army, so I'm going to raise me one.
Yeah, well, no, and that's the thing. It gets back to the nature of the executive branch. It's sort of, you know, it just has a tendency towards dictatorship, you know? I mean,
right, because it is power, and you kind of look at the... You kind of wonder about the framers a little bit, and maybe Dr. Bill O'Brien would be a big help on this. I don't know. But you look at the framers, and they had good sense, or reasonably, you know, for a bunch of misogynistic slave-holding white people, they had good sense about the judiciary in creating a Supreme Court that was a panel and not an individual.
Yeah.
They had good sense about the legislative branch in creating two, or at least arguably, in creating two branches so that there would be some dynamic tension among everybody who comprised it. But then they created the executive and said, we're going to vest that power in one guy.
Well, yeah, and also, I mean, I understand the idea because the cabal, you know, if they thought about having more than one person. And I agree with Hamilton in that, you know, a cabal is even more unaccountable. You know, on some levels, because it's, you know, sort of shadowy and whatnot. But unfortunately, they didn't seem to foresee how easily the House would just sort of vacate its power at the dropping. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's what's gone on. Even the War Power Act, my favorite whipping boy, is like, dude, you were giving them even more power with that.
You know,
by allowing them to send people over for 60 days, the Constitution didn't even invest power. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you want to look at the Congress and just look at the what? Do you not like your jobs? You run like hell. You raise all kinds of money to keep the job, and then you get up there and you don't want to do it.
Yeah, no. It's just, you know, and so, I mean, it's just if you combine the executive branch with the personhood of corporations, you know, you just get a really toxic mix going on here. And unfortunately, we out here, we're the losers on this deal. Big time.
Funny how it always works out that way.
Well, I just don't, you know, I can't even believe that I'm looking at, you know, some person with a dark face getting a Nobel Prize talking that gibberish. You know, I'm like, come on, dude.
I know.
No,
I know.
It was just, no, ain't no time for America to be doing nothing but trying to get its own damn house in order. And we're not uniquely qualified to, you know, conduct these war of aggression and profit centers, you know?
Well, let me ask you a question, Sam.
Ugh.
Let me just ask a quick question. Is all this, and I don't know if I'm coining a phrase or if this even makes sense, is this entire speech a case of what I call responsive politics? Where or defensive politics, like defensive driving, where he's doing this as a means of responding to the baggers, the birthers, the tenthers, and the deathers out there, and it has no real independent existence apart from a political need to respond.
Well, I don't really know. You know, I'm not. You know, it's horrible for me to think that the low politics of the United States has to keep drifting on the world stage. It's like, that is an insult to real people who are out there, you know, really trying to create peace. You know, that now the Nobel Prize is just yet another platform, you know, for the U.S. to, you know, try to get right. Because it's not working. It's embarrassing. I know you and I weren't the only ones feeling that.
No, I don't think so. I was watching my Facebook page over the course of the day, and I saw several people who were less than thrilled with the address. And frankly, you know, I don't want to come across as being some sort of pacifist, or maybe I do. But there's one speech that you give in Norway when you're accepting the Nobel Peace Prize. I am going to continue to work for peace. You don't sit there and give a bunch of ex post facto or, in fact, pre-justifications, one way or the other. You don't give a bunch of those for why you're going to continue to slaughter people.
No, you don't invoke just war. I'm still reeling from that, because that whole idea is far from settled, if you know what I mean. It's incredibly controversial. You know what I mean?
All you have to do is consider the source of the so-called doctrine, and boom, you know.
Right.
I mean, wasn't that something that was papally espoused? The just war doctrine?
Was it?
I'm thinking maybe. You know, because, you know, back in the day when the Pope had some power.
Damn.
And you had Portugal wanting to get it on with Spain, and Spain wanting to get it on with England, and a majority Roman Catholic Europe. You had the popes declaring which wars were just and which wars were not. For instance, if Spain wants to send a great big giant navy to attack England, that was a just war, because England was in apostasy and therefore deserved to be punished for its heresies. That's the origin of just war.
Well, and then I don't know, it's the same thing as that American exceptionalism.
There, that was the other one I was going to get to. That's what this whole speech was.
Right, it's more, you know, it's more of that garbage at this point. I guess he couldn't just go up there and talk about peace after what he's doing. I understand that, but man, that was painful.
Yeah, but can't you leave Dr. King and Gandhi quietly in their graves?
That's what I'm saying. I was like, oh.
I mean, if you want, under the circumstances, if you want to get up there and refer to somebody, somebody who's won the award, maybe get up there, you know, under the circumstances, get up there and talk about Henry Kissinger. Because that's what we're doing in Iraq and Afghanistan is. That's just hateful old Nixonian Kissinger politics extended into the new century.
Well, I even think it's worse than the Kissinger, because Obama is sort of, you know, trying to invoke this Wilsonian BS, which is even more disturbing. It's like no.
Yeah, because he dragged Woodrow out and flogged him around a little bit.
Yeah, anytime people bring in Wilson right now, you know, you always need to be concerned, because Wilson,
Wilson is the guy who coined the phrase, make the world safe for democracy.
Right, right.
And Wilson was also a justification that was hauled out and trotted around by the Bush thugs when they started all this crap.
No, I know, but they're not going to, my foreign policy tendency, if you want to deal with any of these people, is more Jeffsonian. And you'll never hear these people talking about that, you know, because he wasn't in the armies, the whole nine yards, and it's so over the top, because we don't have the wherewithal or funds or anything for this Afghanistan. I mean, I don't know. Have they sent them? When are they going to send them over anyway? Do you know a timeline for that?
Doesn't it start in January?
Oh, God. Is that some weather-dictated stuff?
I think it's probably logistics. You know, we got to buy the gas. You know, and you know, make sure the planes are fueled up and all of, and then, you know, bye-bye. Greetings from sunny Kandahar.
I know that, out of the really bright listening audience that is with the horn, I'm sure someone can call in and break down the the just war thing.
I would not be surprised to see if he hears tonight's broadcast. I would not be surprised to get a lengthy discourse on just war from Eugene Finnerman. If anybody has history at his very fingertips, it's Eugene.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just sort of the way they can just sort of make everything into Madison Avenue. You know, it's disgusting. It's like, oh, what? Now we're going to flog just war. Now is that going to be the buzzword for the liberal cruise missile crew?
Well, the easy cheat, of course, and I've got one at my fingertips, is simply to use the Google.
Oh, yeah.
And let me just share with you what they say about just war at Wikipedia.
Oh.
You ready?
Yeah.
Just war theory is a doctrine of military ethics of Roman philosophical and Catholic origin, studied by moral theologians, ethicists, and international policymakers, which holds that a conflict can and ought to meet the criteria of philosophical, religious, or political justice, provided it follows certain conditions. And the just war theory is an authoritative Catholic Church teaching confirmed by the United States Catholic bishops in their pastoral letter, The Challenge of Peace, God's Promise, and Our Response, issued in 1983. More recently, the Catechism of the Catholic Church in paragraph 2309 lists four strict conditions for legitimate defense by military force. Those four are, one, the damage inflicted by the aggressor on the nation of, or community of nations must be lasting, grave, and certain. All other means of putting an end to it must have been shown to be impractical or ineffective. Three, there must be serious prospects of success. And four, the use of arms must not produce evils and disorders graver than the evil to be eliminated. The power of modern means of destruction weighs very heavily in evaluating this condition.
Oh, yeah. Well, then, obviously, it's just some gobbledygook, man.
Yeah, I know. Turn the magic eight ball over. Answer hazy. Ask again later.
Well, no, I don't mean what you're saying. I mean the way he's trying to use it, because none of what we're doing even holds close to that.
Right. No, we can't meet either A, B, C, or D, even a little bit.
Even if you disagree with the doctrine, which I do, I think it's a load, considering the institutions that it's coming out of. But it doesn't even, he can't, you know, it doesn't even match with that. It's a, wow, well, that's special. Oh, I see Kelly is
going to
be the new coach at Notre Dame.
Sorry. Yeah. Speaking of the church, yeah, the smoke went up from Notre Dame's administration building this evening.
I heard you had a little bit of a drink problem though. How to go reconcile that?
Oh well, you know, if who cares if he drinks tequila through a straw if he wins?
Oh. Yeah, well,
you know, as long as he hadn't dummied up his resume, or, but you know, he'll be gone in 5 years.
But they didn't give Willingham. What did they give him, a year?
Three, I think.
Oh, he had three. Oh, did he get paid though when he left too?
There was some sort of a buyout, but it wasn't anything compared to Charlie Weiss's.
They owe that fool like $18 million, don't they?
They're in the hole.
Well, whatever, pay up. I'm sure he's on his way to, I don't know, Baltimore or back to New England. Who knows?
And some say Chicago.
Chicago?
Yeah, I've heard Chicago's going to be in that mix for Charlie.
Well, God knows they need it.
You know, that's like, I just got an email in from William saying, am I delusional, or didn't Obama say while running his high-profile campaign of hope and change that he was going to go over all of George G.W.'s signing statements line by line that broke the Constitution and remove them? Or should I refer to these statements as power grabs? He said, William says, perhaps I imagined this. By the time this reaches the end of the path to destruction, a term called unjustified yet rightful war, what will we have left if we add up all the death caused by this insanity?
Yeah, you know? I'm sorry. I mean, I really have to just console myself with, you know, my understanding of the presidency. Sometimes it helps to, like, know a little bit about something, you know, because otherwise you're, like, going crazy in your head. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but the thing is, sometimes the knowledge is a sort of, grim existential realization, Sandra.
Oh, no, I know. But, I mean, it's just sometimes, you know, just to have some to the anchor, because this is craziness.
For me, the Milesian, Melian dialogue says it all. You know, the great nations do as they wish. Lesser nations do as they must.
Oh, right, yes, the weak, yes, shut the hell up, you did not bring that out. I love that quote, the weak do what they need to or do what they can. Yeah, that's not nice.
But it's terribly realpolitik, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was a phrase, that was like the opening salvo in that whole way of thinking.
Yeah. And we still haven't gotten it right. How about us?
Oh, I tell you. Well, listen, you know, let me let you go because, I don't know, I got to do some grades.
Oh, that sounds fun.
And they're not that great. I think these poor youngins are going to be shot.
Hey, you know, you got to apply the curve. Don't be harsh.
Oh, God. I can't be down as some a-hole who gives a bunch of D's.
No, you don't have tenure yet.
No, well, it's not even that kind of party, but you know how it is. It's politics everywhere.
Oh, sure, but it can't be fun. I mean, that's got to be a grim business when you look at something and you go, God, this kid sat in a class for an entire semester and didn't even get it.
Well, no, that's the thing I was trying to tell the kids towards the end. I said, you know, you don't want to take this class again, because this class you have to, like, graduate from college. It's one of those requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why they have so many TAs and extra people helping. But they don't seem to get it. And then I said, you know, don't look for me on campus next semester. Okay? Because a lot of them are going to be looking crazy when they get that less than C-minus, you know?
Brutal.
Anyway, yeah, it is brutal. But it's just, you know, it's all a lot of bunch of social Darwinistic shit going on.
Oh, yeah, and you will be tickled to know. I'll let you go real quick. They have now taken the Just Wars thing. I'm looking at an email that I just got from Jude up in the Great Northwest, headlined Conservative Praise for Nobel Speech. President Barack Obama's Nobel Peace Prize speech Thursday is drawing praise from some unlikely quarters, conservative Republicans, who likened Obama's defense of just wars to the worldview of his predecessor, Republican George W. Bush. It's already being called the Obama Doctrine, a notion that foreign policy is a struggle of good and evil, that American exceptionalism... Boy, we got it ahead of the game. We are living out in front of the curb. Sandra, we're on straight road. That American exceptionalism has blunted the force of tyranny in the world, and that U.S. military can be a force for good and even harnessed to humanitarian ends.
Right. You know what? It don't take but a few books to learn the language of the elite.
Oh, I know. And they cite in particular that Newt and Caribou Barbie are loving it.
No, but what's so scary, though, is that Obama is not Bush. He's far more articulate. So if he's going to take that mantle on... Well, hell, I guess we're on to World War III. It is a Nixon go to China moment. Because this fool's going to start waging war everywhere.
God help us all.
You know, it's sort of, you know I have to go racial. It's like, are you kidding me? Some Negro is doing this? No. And on that note, I'll see you soon.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Bye.
Later, Sandra. Oh. And, you know, feel free to chime in. There's open lines, 877-443-2366. We can talk about this all night, but I do have to reserve a little bit of time for another kind of hissy, but I'll have that, you know, at your convenience, not mine. Well, let's roll along. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Garrett.
Yeah, think that the rest of the world's like, using the happy words after that speech, I didn't even bother to watch because I knew this was coming. That he'd try and justify his troop increase. It was going to happen because everybody at home's all like, "Huh, what?" The base is all mad. Now the whole world realizes that. Nay, nothing changed.
Yeah, Satan. Welcome to here's the new boss. Meet the new boss.
Yeah. I mean, you know.
I love this Politico write-up. You know, they're of dubious quality anyway. But the Politico write-up for the speech says, the context was striking. The president is enormously popular in Norway. A crowd of several thousand waited at his hotel chanting Obama, 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 and yes we can, yes we can, yes we can.
Yeah. And afterwards...
Yes we can what, Garrett? Yes we can bomb the world?
Oh, have I got a bumper for this one.
And then, you know, he goes along with the Senate, which is official. I mean, we have to just declare it a non-working body because, I mean, yes, the House put forth a bill that's not perfect by any sense of the word, but at least had a public option. I mean, at least it had that much. I mean, in the Senate, no, sorry.
Yeah. I know.
No, it's like, you know, it's like, yeah, sure, you know, we'll knock down, you know, Medicare debt so that it's now down to people that are 55. Oh, yeah, that's great, you know. It's like, but that's an age where I should know. Both my parents are over 55 now. Like, that's definitely an age group where health problems are. I mean, my father's having less than a week away from a second knee surgery in the past calendar year. So, like, I know that this is what the insurance companies want.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, because because they're both my parents are using my mother's insurance. If something happens and she leaves that job, they'd have to go to Medicare if this stupid law passes as is, because there's no way. I mean, my dad's had surgery on both knees now, and this one, I think, is going to be a knee replacement from what I understand. It's just no way that, you know, they wouldn't consider it pre-existing conditions.
Sure it is. And yeah. Under those circumstances, where would he go? Remember the Aetna story from a couple of nights ago?
Yeah. And it's just...
I mean, they're deliberately running off 650,000 of their policyholders? And
yeah.
and here's the fun part. They get to, because God forbid we should regulate the little bastards.
Yeah, it's bad enough that we're not, the family isn't exactly in the greatest condition ever. If everybody's, you know, in the family is healthy, you know, we're not exactly, we're going to be limping for a couple of months here when my dad's on the mend. We were earlier this year when he was on the mend. And it's just, you know, the Senate, oh, I mean, you know, it's like, and now it's almost January. Unless there's people filing for primary challenges, what are we going to get? I mean, because
you're asking that $64 question. I mean, there you sit in Nevada, Garrett. You know, you get out there and put some feet on the street. Get active. Get rid of Harry Reid. You know, maybe what Lottie said on the show was right. Maybe we're at a point where you do just throw the bums out. I don't know.
I think at this point that Reid is toast anyway. The problem is, There's no primary challenger. He has enough power in this state to where nobody's stepped up. But there's a big feeding frenzy on the right that I told you about a couple months ago. But I'm pretty certain that Reed's gonna bite the big one. But it's gonna be a freaking another right winger. And that's the last thing, that's not exactly much of a progress.
I know, and I know there's, you know, there is an undercurrent out there, Garrett, of you know, let it go. But the fact that, we've gone back and forth on that very dynamically tense issue on a number of occasions with a whole bunch of contributors from the Horn phone, from the Horn, family.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, if you just let it go, a lot of people suffer. But the question is, and you know what? We may be able to answer this question by 2012. What has it done for us so far? All the effort and all the $5 is that we've contributed.
Oh, certainly.
It's a tough and painful question.
I mean, because I am ready to just, I mean, I am ready to let Reed, you know, twist in the wind. I mean, I'm...
Well, what in God's name has he done, Garrett?
He's done nothing. I mean, the only...
I mean, I'm not barking at you. You know that.
Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, I will not forget reading the descriptions of the candidates. It just, like, face-palming myself on the blurbs, you know, about Reed's positions versus this Zeiser fool that ran against him in 2004. It's like, Zeiser was like, we need a federal, you know, anti-gay marriage, you know, amendment. That was his only issue. And Reed was like, well, we already have DOMA. We don't need anything else. And I was like,
yeah, because the answer to that is shut up, you freak.
Yeah. I mean, I already...
But okay, now see, the devil is, as ever, in the details, Garrett. Let me throw one out there for you, one of those details.
Okay.
We bemoan the presence of corporate money in Democratic Party politics. Okay? I mean, that's
yeah.
just a given. And we know that the easiest solution to all of this is to somehow or another get the corporate money out of American politics. But that's all wrapped up in corporate personhood and stuff that we could spend 8 shows on.
Yes.
So when we throw the bums out, and a lot of those bums are Democrats, when we throw the bums out, the corporate money is just going to shift over to whoever the new incumbent is. And they're going to be as hard or harder to throw out than the present incumbent bum is. Because, see, corporate America doesn't like Democrats. All right? Let's be clear on that. They give to Democrats because it's just prudent. It's bet hedging. But if they get somebody in there that'll really, really do the work for them, they'll double down. Sorry, just had to use a Vegas phrase there, but they will.
Yeah.
And it will become next to impossible to dislodge them. I mean, my God, look at how long, how many people have ever run against Orrin Hatch in Utah? How many have won? The answer, zero.
Yeah.
You know, where is, you know, if we're going to throw the bums out and get somebody new, who's the somebody new going to be against Jim Demented in South Carolina? Who's the somebody going to be against Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III in Alabama? Who's the new guy going to be against Mary Landrieu in Louisiana? Who's the new guy going to be against their replacements? Who's the new guy going to be against the replacement for Ben Nelson in Nebraska? Is, you know, look, I can't even, with the exception of the extremely kind-hearted and dedicated people who help us hang on by a fingernail here on the Horn, we can't get liberal money to pay staff on this program. How are we going to fund those great liberal hopes in places like Nebraska and Alabama and Mississippi?
It's just, I mean, especially with everybody freaking barely able to pay their own bills, much less.
Right, and I mean, is this the part where you just sort of, maybe you do what Alan said the other night and show them your disgust and register, you know, register the green or Sparkle Pony Party or, you know, whatever you want.
Yeah, but Bob, there's a problem. In this state, in Nevada, if you register independent, because prior to a few years ago, I was independent, you can't vote for crap in the primaries unless you're one of the parties. That's how
right.
Nevada
does. But the thing is, primaries are not elections. Okay?
Yeah.
Primaries are basically popular nominating conventions.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to go that route, what matters is November. But the other part of that is if you're going to go that route and go green, or in the case of West Virginia, go Mountain Party, what you have to do is you can't do it half-heartedly. You have to register, and then you go out there and you put your ass in the sling. And I'm not saying yours, okay? I'm saying everybody's.
Yeah.
And you run for some office. You know, don't be a crackpot and run for Congress. Run for city council. Run for something. Run for something reasonably attainable so that it's something more than a symbolic candidacy. And this is where, dollars come into it because somebody's got to buy gasoline to get around. But some of this is just grunt labor, and it is the hardest, nastiest work of the political process. This is the West Virginia reference. It's volunteer fire department bean dinner after bean dinner after bean dinner, where you get to the point that you've ate ramps and beans till you can't take a step without farting. Okay, I mean it just is. It's churches, and it's a day planner that since you're a third party candidate, you will have to manage by yourself with no support whatsoever. And like Alan said, the two mainstream parties will turn the vast amount of their venom and invective on you. And if you've got the first little chicken bone of a skeleton in your closet, you will be flogged mercilessly with it. So let's at least be real clear-eyed. Let's get all the starry-eyed idealism out of it and be real straight up about what we're talking about here. Now, I'm not condemning the process, Garrett. But I don't, I don't do faith much. And I don't do hope much. If there's a Bible verse I like more than any other, it's that one that says faith without works is dead.
And isn't it the truth? I mean, because the thing is that, a great deal of us bought into the hope and, all that. And it's like, okay, and it's like, here we are, and it's not much better.
Yeah, what are we hoping for in Afghanistan? What's going to change in Afghanistan? Yeah. What's going to be different about American troops in Afghanistan, 30,000 or maybe eventually 60,000 or 100,000 more than what George Bush sent over there? What's going to be different in Afghanistan when they're still there in 5 years or 15 or 20 like Hamid Karzai says he wants?
Yeah.
Where's the hope? Where's the change? And, I'm sure I'm pissing people off right now, Garrett, because there is still a hardcore of people who think that Obama's going to quote Bruce Springsteen, be the savior that rises from these streets. But I ain't seeing it, and I'm certainly not feeling it, though I'm not much one for feelings.
Well, I certainly understand that. I mean, because the thing is that there's a law. I mean, by doing all of this, Obama is really playing with fire because a lot of people are ticked off. I mean, you got the brain dead teabaggers who just don't know. They're being played off of, oh, he's a black man, he's a Muslim. Hartman loves to call them low information voters, which they are. And, it's as simple as, the fact is that at some point they're going to get really angry.
They are.
Yeah. I mean, but real, just like, they're kind of an annoyance. We can kind of laugh at them at this point, but I mean, like, crazy, scary, angry.
Well, but see, I don't know, Garrett, I'm not taking issue with you. I ain't laughing anymore. Those people are dangerous. They're carrying guns to peaceful public town hall meetings. They're wearing T-shirts praying for God to kill the president of the United States. They're shooting people in their churches. They're murdering security guards at the Holocaust Museum. They're already running batshit wild, Garrett.
Yes, this is very true, and that's.
Yeah, and frankly, I gotta say, and you get into what we do here at the Horn, and you're at it for a few years, and the one thing you want to try to be is consistent, and then a couple of years in, you realize that the one thing you're going to be is human and flawed, and I'm sure that I have at this point in time contradicted myself so many times that the trail sort of goes back and forth over itself a million times.
But I'm frustrated as hell. And that's, you know, that's the bottom line of it. I mean, there's a website that I use for a lot of my information on this program, and they do awesome, good work. And I'm just looking at one of the posts, and it says, 44 lawmakers sign on to Christmas resolution despite Boehner's tirade against frivolous bills. Well, la-ti-da. You know, I'm sure that at some point in time there would be some show where I could do 15 or 20 minutes on that and just have a big old hissy. But it's gotten way too serious for that. It's gotten way too grave, hasn't it, Garrett?
At this point, I can't help but agree. I mean, you know, and again, to, you know, not to, you know, repeat everything that's on Hartman, but Hartman's trying to get people, you know, talk to these people, rationalize with these people, you know, not make fun of them, but, you know, convince them that, yeah, you have a reason to be pissed off, you know, but you need to, you know.
I guess where I disagree with Hartman on that is that the base level of the birthers and the deathers and the tenthers and the baggers and the boogers and whatever they are, the base level for their disgust and hatred of Barack Obama is not the same base level of disgust that I have. Or frustration,
and,
or whatever you want to call it.
I agree with that. I find, you know, they're, because...
Loonies hate him for his skin color, and ain't nothing going to get past it. You can't reason with them, because they are, by virtue of that racial bigotry, about, they're so far past reason that the light from reason won't reach them for a million years.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why I bring it up, because it's starting to get, and we know that if Obama actually does something remotely liberal, we're going to have, you know, it ain't going to be a couple of nutballs that want to get on reality TV that slip through the cracks. It's going to be somebody really scary, because we already had hints of something like that happening during the campaign.
Do you remember the convention when they stopped a couple of skinheads in Denver?
Yeah, precisely. I mean, and that's, you know, it's not enough to make me feel, you know, sympathy for Obama, you know, in his plight or what have you. But the fact is that there are people that do not want him to be there, and it's like the old joke, they show you he gets to be president, and then they show him, you know, footage of
JFK, and he goes, hey, that's not the Zapruder film.
Precisely.
Where do I sign? Yeah, Bill Hicks, God, that peace be upon him, as Albert says. Hey, Garrett, I got to roll along, brother, but this is a great conversation, and thanks for cluing me in on the Brian Kelly thing before the broadcast. Yeah, we got to have our priorities here. Smoke went up from the Golden Dome.
Yeah. Good smoke or bad smoke, that's the problem.
Well, you know, it's Notre Dame. Yeah, I know you're a fan.
Well, I like the team, and I don't even want them to frickin' succeed at this point. They just drive me insane.
Well, that's because there are some severely misplaced priorities in it all. You know, $4.5 million coaches plus bonuses at the Alabama. How's Notre Dame not going to pay that? What's it going to cost? And I realize they're richer than rich, but still, you know, the balance sheets being what they are, what is an academic? This is a fundamental philosophic question. What does an academic institution sacrifice in order to pursue a cut glass egg? I think it's a fair question.
Yeah, because they already cut a bunch of, they ticked off like a bunch of alumni in the 90s when they cut a bunch of, you know, low revenue programs, and that was in the middle of the Holtz regime, and they were raking in the NBC money. I mean, now they're
long's that NBC gig gonna last? But wow, we just ran afield from a very serious discussion. Garrett, we'll talk soon, brother. Have a good evening. All right,
later, Bob.
Later now. And we're going to take a quick break. We're at 14 minutes past the hour. Light them up if you want to. 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on your nickel, 304-658-3333. Coming up, the Green News Report with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. right here on America's listener-supported liberal voice, right here on the Horn.
Yes, we can bomb most any land. On CNN with marching bands. Pour ourselves an ice cold Coke. Make a war. Tell a joke. Over me, the fear and insecurity. Yes, I am American. From Pearl Harbor to Afghanistan. History, and brother, that lesson didn't come for free. The politicians, they didn't bleed. Misguided patriots, indeed, indeed, indeed.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Thursday, December 10, 2009.
Obama's Nobel Green Prize? Climate talks.
What do you want? Climate justice! What do you want? No!
And protests continue in Copenhagen. Plus, what should we call the decade since 2000? How about the hottest ever?
All of that and more straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman of Bradblog.com.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of green news,
politics, and snarky comment.
The North Polar ice cap is melting before our very eyes. It's been the size of the continental United States for most of the last 3 million years, and now suddenly 40% of it's gone, and the rest of it is expected to disappear within 5, 10, 15 years.
Oh, Al Gore, didn't you read those emails? It's all a hoax, although it seems someone forgot to tell the polar ice caps. This is your Green News Report. The Green News Report is brought to you by VelvetRevolution.us, now offering a $200,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of U.S. Chamber of Commerce CEO Tom Donahue for fraud and other crimes. Demand an investigation for the Chamber's irresponsible behavior on global warming and so much more. Sign the petition at StopTheChamber.com. That's StopTheChamber.com. Okay, Des, it's a big week moving ahead in Copenhagen, but in the meantime, it's not just the polar ice caps that aren't listening to the climate deniers. The icebergs don't seem to understand that this is all a hoax.
That's true. There is a very rare sighting of a 54-square-mile iceberg floating towards Australia.
Iceberg, move ahead!
Headed towards Australia. Unusual, yes?
Yes, very rare to have that once-in-a-century occurrence, they say.
Other than that, everything's fine. All right, what else do we have this week?
President Obama accepted the Nobel Peace Prize this morning in Oslo, Norway. In his speech, the president called for international cooperation to address climate change as a critical component of peace.
If we do nothing, we will face more drought, more famine, more mass displacement, all of which will fuel more conflict for decades. It's not merely scientists and environmental activists who call for swift and forceful action. It's military leaders and others who understand our common security hangs in the balance.
Numerous recent studies from the Department of Defense, national security think tanks, and other nations have outlined the threat to international security from potentially destabilizing effects of climate change on fragile governments.
We're talking about wars over resources, climate refugees, fleeing countries. These are serious national security concerns, correct?
Yes. It's said that with a 1 meter sea level rise, 1 billion people will have to be moved. Protesters in Copenhagen.
350! 350!
Protesters outside the summit in Copenhagen shouted 350 in support of the tiny Pacific island nation of Tuvalu, already confronting rising sea levels. 350 stands for 350 parts per million, the threshold of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that scientists say the world should target to avoid catastrophic climate change. Tuvalu delegates attempted to introduce an amendment calling for deeper, legally binding emissions reductions, but the proposal was blocked from coming to the floor after objections from industrialized and oil-producing nations. There appears to be an emerging split among developing nations at the conference. Nations that will be disproportionately hit by climate change, like island nations, Tuvalu and the Maldives, along with poor nations like Senegal, are pushing for the 350 limit. But fast developing nations with booming economies, like China, are siding with rich nations and opposing the target for fear it will hamper economic growth.
Maldives is the country where they're concerned that the entire island may disappear. They recently had an underwater
cabinet meeting.
To highlight the fact that that whole island nation could disappear if the waters continue to rise.
Other developments out of Copenhagen. U.S. negotiators rejected a proposal by China for developed nations to pay so-called reparations to developing nations for past carbon emissions. Meanwhile, the U.S. called for deeper commitments from fast-growing developing nations like China, where the bulk of future emissions growth is expected to occur. Saudi Arabia has latched on to the story of hacked and stolen emails from climate scientists to call for no action at the conference until an investigation is completed.
Saudi Arabia doesn't want action? What interest could Saudi Arabia possibly have in stopping the move to renewable energy sources? I'm confused.
I'm thinking. Danish police raided the lodgings of activist groups overnight, confiscating items they said were intended for civil disobedience at the conference, including paint bombs and props, but made no arrests. Next week, police say they expect an influx of protesters to coincide with the arrival of world leaders. While the talks in Copenhagen are focused on policy and economics, the decade is now officially the hottest on record. The World Meteorological Association released findings that this past decade, from 2000 to 2009, is now officially the hottest on record, surpassing global average temperatures in the 90s. Also this week, the U.S. National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Agency, NOAA, has independently released findings that confirm the same thing. The 2000s are now the hottest decade in recorded history.
That's impossible. I'm just not going to buy what these scientists have to say when I have emailers telling me otherwise. If you'd like to be one of those emailers, drop us a note at greennews.bradblog.com. You can also follow us on Twitter, download us on iTunes, and join the discussion at our blog, greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your hottest ever Green News Report.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
See, big money's coming to town. Mom and pop be closing down. Prices falling, wages too. There ain't nothing you can do. Sip, put on that smiley face. Go down working for a lesser wage. Yankee dollar.
Twenty-eight minutes past the hour. And that, of course, the inimitable John Kuntz and Yankee Dollar. Let's go straight to the phones. You can light them up if you want to. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877-4-HEAD-ON, or 304-658-3333. Well, that call I lost. I want to go somewhere real quick because you know how it is with me in comparison and contrast. Once an English major, always an English major. Compare and contrast the writings of Mark Twain with those of the Marquis de Sade. You know how it is, right? I want to take you back. We all know what was in the Nobel speech today. Am I broadcasting? I think I'm broadcasting. Kind of wait and see. Everything's square here. Hang on. Okay, sorry for the silence. Oh, someday we'll have a whole team working on this. Okay. No, we're still going. All right, well, no worries. Okay. Anyway, you know how I am with perspective. And we all know what was in the really good speech today. Well, I want to share something, and I'm reminded, you know, they say that when Abraham Lincoln, at the time when Abraham Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address, the style of the day was to speak on ad nauseam, ad infinitum, and that Lincoln crafted his Gettysburg Address riding on the train from D.C. to Gettysburg, and some say crafted it on the back of an envelope or some such. And that it took, the guy who spoke before him went on like for 2 hours. Whereas Lincoln got up and spoke and if he spoke for 5 minutes, it may have just be 3 minutes. I remember memorizing the Gettysburg Address for delivery in fifth grade and thinking that having to memorize that was going to take forever. And I stood up, I said it, and I sat down, and it took no time at all. And yet it is one of the most brilliant pieces of oratory in the history of this republic. Well, let's do a little time traveling. No, not to the Gettysburg Address. Let's do a little time traveling. Let's compare Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speeches. I take you back to December the 10th, 1964. The place, of course, Oslo, Norway. I do not have a recording, so you'll have to put up with me reading. Somebody start the clock. Okay. 8, 9, 10. I accept the Nobel Prize for Peace at a moment when 22 million Negroes of the United States of America are engaged in a creative battle to end the long night of racial injustice. I accept this award in behalf of a civil rights movement which is moving with determination and a majestic scorn for risk and danger to establish a reign of freedom and a rule of justice. I am mindful that only yesterday in Birmingham, Alabama, our children crying out for brotherhood were answered with fire hoses, snarling dogs, and even death. I am mindful that only yesterday in Philadelphia, Mississippi, young people seeking to secure the right to vote were brutalized and murdered. And only yesterday, more than 40 houses of worship in the state of Mississippi alone were bombed or burned because they offered a sanctuary to those who would not accept segregation. I am mindful that debilitating and grinding poverty afflicts my people and chains them to the lowest rung of the economic ladder. Therefore, I must ask why this prize is awarded to a movement which is beleaguered and committed to unrelenting struggle, to a movement which has not won the very peace and brotherhood which is the essence of the Nobel Prize. After contemplation, I conclude that this award, which I receive on behalf of that movement, is profound recognition that nonviolence is the answer to the crucial political and moral question of our time, the need for man to overcome oppression and violence without resorting to violence and oppression. Civilization and violence are antithetical concepts. Negroes of the United States, following the people of India, have demonstrated that nonviolence is not sterile passivity, but a powerful moral force which makes for social transformation. Sooner or later, all the people of the world will have to discover a way to live together in peace and thereby transform this pending cosmic elegy into a creative psalm of brotherhood. If this is to be achieved, man must evolve for all human conflict a method which rejects revenge, aggression, and retaliation. The foundation of such a method is love. The tortuous road, which has led from Montgomery, Alabama to Oslo, bears witness to this truth. This is a road over which millions of Negroes are traveling to find a new sense of dignity. The same road has opened for all Americans a new era of progress and hope. It has led to a new civil rights bill, and it will, I am convinced, be widened and lengthened into a superhighway of justice as Negro and white men in increasing numbers create alliances to overcome their common problems.
I accept this award today with an abiding faith in America and an audacious faith in the future of mankind. I refuse to accept despair as the final response to the ambiguities of history. I refuse to accept the idea that the isness of man's present nature makes him morally incapable of reaching up for the eternal oughtness that forever confronts him. I refuse to accept the idea that man is mere flotsam and jetsam in the river of life, unable to influence the unfolding events which surround him. I refuse to accept the view that mankind is so tragically bound to the starless midnight of racism and war that the bright daybreak of peace and brotherhood can never become a reality. I refuse to accept the cynical notion that nation after nation must spiral down a militaristic stairway into the hell of thermonuclear destruction. I believe that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word in reality. This is why right, temporarily defeated, is stronger than evil triumphant. I believe that even amid today's motor bursts and whining bullets, there is still hope for a brighter tomorrow. I believe that wounded justice lying prostrate on the blood-flowing streets of our nations can be lifted from this dust of shame to reign supreme among the children of men. I have the audacity to believe that peoples everywhere can have 3 meals a day for their bodies, education and culture for their minds, and dignity, equality, and freedom for their spirits. I believe that what self-centered men have torn down, men other-centered can build up. I still believe that one day mankind will bow before the altars of God and be crowned triumphant over war and bloodshed, and nonviolent redemptive goodwill will proclaim the rule of the land. And the lion and the lamb shall lie down together, and every man shall sit under his own vine and fig tree, and none shall be afraid. I still believe that we shall overcome. This faith can give us courage to face the uncertainties of the future. It will give our tired feet new strength as we continue our forward stride toward the city of freedom. When our days become dreary with low hovering clouds and our nights become darker than 1,000 midnights, we will know that we are living in the creative turmoil of a genuine civilization struggling to be born. Today I come to Oslo as a trustee, inspired and with renewed dedication to humanity. I accept this prize on behalf of all men who love peace and brotherhood. I say I come as a trustee, for in the depths of my heart, I am aware that this prize is much more than an honor to me personally. Every time I take a flight, I am always mindful of the man people who make a successful of the many people who make a successful journey possible, the known pilots and the unknown ground crew. So you honor the dedicated pilots of our struggle who have sat at the controls as the freedom movement soared into orbit. You honor once again Chief Luthuli of South Africa, whose struggles with and for his people are still met with the most brutal expression of man's inhumanity to man. You honor the ground crew without whose labor and sacrifices the jet flights to freedom could never have left the earth. Most of these people will never make the headlines, and their names will not appear in Who's Who. Yet when years have rolled past, and when the blazing light of truth is focused on this marvelous age in which we live, men and women will know, and children will be taught, that we have a finer land, a better people, a more noble civilization, because these humble children of God were willing to suffer for righteousness' sake. I think Alfred Nobel would know what I mean when I say that I accept this award in the spirit of a curator of some precious heirloom which he holds in trust for its true owners, all those to whom beauty is truth, and truth beauty, and in whose eyes the beauty
of genuine brotherhood and peace is more precious than diamonds or silver or gold. 8 minutes. 8 minutes. That speech is what a Nobel Peace Prize speech should be. And this speech rejects in advance everything that Barack Obama said today. Yes, Barack Obama gave lip service to Dr. King, but that's all it was. Barack Obama said that, well, you know, just war is necessary sometimes. Dr. King said civilization and violence are antithetical concepts. Barack Obama said today that he reserves the right to unilaterally bomb anyone he sees fit if he perceives a threat. He enunciated, for all intents and purposes, the Florida NRA back shoot 'em if you got 'em bill. All you gotta be is afraid, and then you can kill anybody you want to. Dr. King said, I refuse to accept the cynical notion that nation after nation must spiral down a militaristic stairway. He said, I believe that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word in reality. That is why right temporarily defeated is stronger than evil triumphant. President Obama said he wants to reconcile these two seemingly irreconcilable truths, that war is sometimes necessary and war is at some level an expression of human feelings. We must direct our effort to the task that President Kennedy, they flogged him too, called for long ago. Let us focus, he said, on a more practical, more attainable peace based not on a sudden revolution in human nature, but on a gradual evolution in human institutions. Dr. King did not believe in gradualism. I believe that even amid today's motor bursts and whining bullets, there is still hope for a brighter tomorrow. I believe that wounded justice lying prostrate on the blood-flowing streets of our nations can be lifted from this dust of shame to reign supreme among the children of men. Indeed. Indeed. You tell me who gave a speech about an award for peace, and who gave a speech justifying war. You know, I don't even like saying these things. I don't. I honestly don't. It is more than depressing. And for that, I apologize. But we do sort of live in the reality-based community here, don't we? We do, we do, we do. You know, I said last night that I wasn't going to read it, but or read all of it, and I won't. But events conspire to make me just have to share with you some of the words of Joe Bajant's essay, The Devil and Mr. Obama. Here's an advance warning to the parents of small children in the audience. There are a couple of fun words in here. These are Joe's words, and I will not attempt to edit them. They are his words, and they are art, and they are true, and I'm not going to undo anything he did. He writes, as you may know, Obama's public approval ratings are taking a beating. Millions of his former cult members have awakened with a splitting hangover to find their pockets turned inside out and eviction notices on the doors of their 4,000-square-foot subprime mortgage cardboard fuckboxes. Many who voted for Obama out of disgust for the Bush regime are now listening to the Republicans again on their car radios as they drive around looking for a suitable place to hide their vehicles from the repo man. Don't construe this as support for the GOP. It's just the standard ping-ponging of disappointment and disgust that comes after the honeymoon is over with any administration. Most Americans' party affiliations are the same as they were when Bush was elected. After all, Obama did not get elected on a landslide by any means. He got 51% of the vote. Right now, his approval ratings are in the 40th percentile and would be headed for the basement of the league were it not for the residual effect of the Kool-Aid Love Fest a year ago. However, millions of American liberals remain faithful and believe that Obama will arise from the dead in the third year and ascend to glory. You will find them at Huffington Post. This frustrating ping-pong game, in which the margin of first-time disenchanted and undecided voters are batted back and forth, has become the whole of American elections. That makes both the Republicans and Democratic parties very happy, since it keeps the game down to fighting the enemy they know, each other, as opposed to being forced to deal with the real issues, or worse yet, an independent or third-party candidate who might have a solution or two. Thus, the game is limited to two players between two corporate parties. One is the Republican Party, which believes we should hand over our lives and resources directly to the local Chamber of Commerce so the Chamber can deliver them to the big corporations. The other, the Democratic Party, believes that we should hand our lives and resources to a Democratic administration so it alone can deliver our asses to the big dogs who own the country. In the big picture, it's always about who gets to deliver the money to the Wall Street hyena pack. Americans may be starting to get the big picture about politics, money, and corporate power, but I doubt it. Given that most still believe the war on terrorism is real, and that terrorists always just happen to be found near gas and oil deposits, there is plenty of room left to blow more smoke up their asses, especially considering how we are conditioned to go into blind fits of patriotism at the sight of the flag and eagle, or the mention of our heroes, even if the heroes happen to be killing and maiming Muslim babies at the moment. Patriotism is a cataract that blinds us to all national discrepancies. Much of the rest of the world seems plagued with similar cataracts that keep it from noticing the chasm of discrepancy between what Obama says and what he actually does. The Nobel Committee awarded the 2009 Peace Prize to the very person who dropped the most bombs and killed the most poor people on the planet during that year. The same guy who started a new war in Pakistan, beefed up the ongoing war in Afghanistan, and continues to threaten Iran with attack unless Iran cops to phony U.S.-Israeli charges of secret nuclear weapons facilities. It's weapons of mass destruction all over again. Somewhere in the whole fracas has been forgotten that Iran has been calling for a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East since 1974. Iran has also been consistent in its position that petroleum is a noble material, much too valuable to burn for electricity, and that nuclear energy makes much more sense given that our food supply, whether we like it or not, is fundamentally dependent upon petrochemicals and will remain so until the Earth's population is reduced to at least half of what it is now. The Iranian attitude has been to use the shrinking petroleum deposits as judiciously as possible. To which oil man George Bush replied that there will be consequences for Iran's attitude. Obama has reinforced Bush's sentiment, stating that not only will there be consequences, but that a military strike on Iran is not out of the question. Although nuclear weapons are in direct opposition to the Muslim faith, 71 million Iranians must have shuddered and paused to think, maybe an Iranian bomb isn't such a bad idea after all. Under cover of being the first black president, Obama is looking to best one of the Bush administration's records, and that is causing unshirted hell for anybody two shades darker than a paper bag, particularly if they are wearing sandals, Obama himself being only one shade darker than the bag and given to size 11 black Cole Haans. So far, 2 million Pakistanis have been, in official U.S. State Department jargon, displaced by U.S.-backed bombing and gunfire. Note, that's 2 million, which will surely displace a fellow if anything will. A significant portion of them are living with host families. Translation, packed into crowded houses, tend to a room, wiping out food and water supplies, crashing already fragile sanitation infrastructure, and serving as a giant human petri dish for intestinal and respiratory diseases. Many more are still living in the conflict area. Makes it sound like living next door to a neighborhood domestic squabble, doesn't it? God only knows how many more innocent people will yet be killed in the conflict area of Obama's war of necessity. You know, the good war. The war that's supposed to offset the interminable bad one in Iraq, where we continue to occupy and build more bases. Then there are Obama's noble efforts to fight terrorism by beefing up troop deployment in Afghanistan. Deployment may be construed to mean an American-style armed gangbang in which everybody piles on some wretched flea-bitten hamlets for all they're worth, with periodic breaks for pizza and video games. Now, if you look at the deployment of U.S. forces in Afghanistan compared to NATO country forces there, you'll find them in a nice even line along what could easily be mistaken for an oil pipeline route, one that taps into the natural gas deposits in Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan and, by the purest coincidence, just happens to bypass nearby Russia and Iran. But we all know that it's about fighting terrorism over there, so we won't have to fight it here. That still plays in Peoria, so we're sticking with it. At the moment, out-of-pocket cost of America's wars in Iraq and Afghanistan is $900 billion. Interest on the debt incurred, plus the waste of productive resources on the war, pushes the cost to $3,000 billion, Nobel economist Joseph Stiglitz. By comparison, the entire 2009 government budget for elementary and secondary education is slightly above $800 billion. Or to look at it another way, how far would $3,000 billion go toward establishing energy independence? As Harvard monetary expert Linda Bilmes points out, that there is no benefit whatsoever for any American whose income does not derive from the military security complex. Joe says, I sent an email to Obama pointing this out, suggesting that we all pull out of Afghanistan, grab the opium, and run. I got a nice reply saying that my president is grateful for the input, so there you go. Lately, there's been a ruckus about our little slap shop in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Despite Obama's promises to close down Cigar Land, it is still open for business. Word has it that Cigar Land may be moved to an underused maximum security prison. One would think a scarcity of criminals for a maximum security prison would be good news, but what do I know? In the desperately broke community of Thompson, Illinois. Locals there tell the national press, sure, put it in our backyard, no problem. Or, this town is in the prison business. Prisons are us. Or more bluntly, we know how to handle those creeps and we need the jobs. It's the kind of job creation Stalin would have understood. But at least the recession is over. This, according to Obama's monetary point man, Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank. For British readers unfamiliar with the U.S. system, and he wrote this for a British audience, the Federal Reserve is not a government agency, despite its agency-like name. The Fed is an offshore private banking cartel that decides just how much bogus currency can be printed and circulated profitably for bankers without wrecking their Ponzi schemes. And the chairman of that august body has announced that the recession is over. Well, hallelujah. We can quit rolling our own cigs and buy ready-mades and run recklessly through the dollar store scooping up dented canned goods and cheap Chinese tube socks. That makes us luckier than the 3.5 million Americans, most of whom led normal lives a few years ago, who are now homeless. That includes 1 million schoolchildren sleeping in tents, shelters, and other makeshift arrangements and trying to look presentable each morning at schools that have not even the mercy to let them use the school showers. By the administration's own calculation, the number of homeless and people out of work will continue to escalate at least into the next year. Home foreclosures, and therefore homelessness, has not topped out yet, says Obama. But Bernanke has announced that the recession is over, so there you have it. A grateful nation breathes a sigh of relief. Besides, he's right about it being over. The recession is over for the most important members of a capitalist society, the oligarchs and banksters, who have made fortunes off his recession thanks to our unique economic system, and may now return to their standard garden variety usury. Economic systems are merely belief systems. I didn't say that. Keynes said that. For instance, if the early Assyrians believed a shekel was worth a jar of wheat, then it was worth a jar of wheat. American-style capitalism eventually stretched belief to the absolute limits of fantasy to the snapping point. As regards general credulity, nobody abroad still believes the dollar is worth folding up and sticking in a wallet, certainly not worth exchanging for a good old-fashioned shekel. However, be it shekels or dollars or euros, there is no economic system at all if there is no production, and there is no production if there are no jobs, hence the obsession with unemployment rates. The U.S. Ministry of Truth has announced that our unemployment rate is at 10%. I've yet to meet an American who does not know the official unemployment rate is a complete fiction. One half of the unemployed, the half that has been unemployed for more than 1 year, are simply erased from the official count. Poof! The real rate is somewhere around 20%. But if we acknowledged that, we'd have to admit being on par with Europe's unemployment rate. And by diddle damned, we can never do that. Every American fully understands that the purpose of life is to hang on to one meaningless job or another, two of them if possible, and by the state's official numbers, more Americans have a white-knuckled grip on the life's purpose than any of those pussy socialist European nations with their free health care, low infant mortality rates, and ridiculously long vacations. But the bad news, which the Obama administration openly acknowledges, is that unemployment will in all likelihood go higher, and nobody on earth knows how to reduce it, although no one in the administration is about to acknowledge that. The factories are all but gone, and they're not coming back. Not unless American workers are willing to work 13 hours a day for 2 Chinese yuan an hour, which is about 31 cents, what U.S. factories remain are laying workers off due to high interest rates and waiting for a lower interest rate policy before deciding if it's feasible to call any workers back into production. During their wait, they can watch hell freeze over. Banks know a fatter hog when they see it, and that hog is the consumer credit business. Nobody's figured out yet that consumers need paychecks before they can consume anything, or on credit or otherwise. To that end, the Federal Reserve has logically set a low interest rate policy, and in true accordance with banking logic, the banks took the Fed's money, then raised the annual percentage rate on credit card purchases and cash advances and on balances that have a penalty rate because of late payment. Next, they raised the late fee. What the hell? If Americans are on the ropes struggling to make their payments on time, then the logical thing to do is to stick it to them. Bleed them for all they're worth. It's an American free market tradition. We, the people, do not complain. We expect no mercy. America is a business, and the American concept of business is pure ruthlessness. A Deutsche Bank analyst tells me a near-term worst is yet to come. Bank failures and home foreclosures have not peaked. A commercial real estate bust is coming down the pike. He says that while there will be some minor periodic upswings, the fraudulent value of the dollar is now evident as it falls against every other currency, even the Russian ruble, 13%, except those unlucky enough to be pegged to the U.S. dollar. As former Assistant Secretary of Treasury Paul Craig Roberts says, what sort of recovery is it when the safest investment an American can make is to bet against the U.S. dollar? My Deutsche Bank friend, who is younger and has a family to think about, has taken what he considers more appropriate action. He's buying gold and moving to an undeveloped Central American country. But Mr. Bernanke assures us that the worst is indeed over. Despite the outside world's serious doubts, but Bernanke's announcement just might fly in the U.S. We believe whatever our Ministry of Truth tells us. We believed that debt was wealth, didn't we? And we believed in WMDs and have come to believe warfare is a prerequisite to peace. The saddest thing is that Americans are cultivated like mushrooms from birth to death, kept in the dark and fed horse shit. Consequently, they haven't the slightest idea that there is an alternative to the system in which they labor at the pleasure of corporate and financial elites who own both their government and their every waking hour. That alternative is democratic socialism, self-government for the broadest common good, which the Ministry of Truth has defined for them as fascism. And we're not even halfway, and I'm not going to do the whole thing. That's just not fair to do to you. But you get the idea. We are in the midst of some sort of Shakespearean dumb show. And there's plenty of evidence to support the principle. There are real crises in this country and on this planet. What Brad and Desi said in the Green News Report is true. There's no damn debate about the fact that this is the hottest decade on record ever. And there's nothing to suggest that the next decade won't be hotter than this one, and the next one after that hotter than the one before. Hot, 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 just getting hot in here, getting hotter and hotter and hotter, and no amount of air conditioners is going to fix it. A brilliant piece of writing here from the folks over at thinkprogress.org, the consequences of global warming from A to Z. A, East Antarctica, long stable, is now losing ice. B, Bolivia needs $1 billion over the next 7 years to build reservoirs as the glaciers that hold the nation's water supply are shrinking rapidly. C, leatherback sea turtles that spawn on the beaches of Costa Rica are threatened with extinction by warmer temperatures and rising seas. D, Denmark joined the United States, Norway, Canada, and Russia in identifying climate change as the most important long-term threat to the future existence of polar bears. E, the rapidly warming highlands of Ethiopia are becoming too hot for its elite athletes, such as local-born Haile Gebrselassie, to train there. F, noting the unprecedented floods this year in Fiji, Prime Minister Commodore Vereke Bainimarama recently warned that rising sea levels affect not just the island's economies, but put into doubt the very existence of his nation. G, Greece, suffered through another storm of extreme wildfires this summer as heat waves and drier conditions increase. H, global warming, fueled hurricanes, intense poverty, and widespread deforestation combined to form a gathering storm of ongoing disasters for Haiti. I, the deforested peatlands of Indonesia are drying, disintegrating, and burning. Jay, the increasingly early arrival of cherry blossoms in Japan reflects rising global temperatures. K, the more frequent and severe droughts that are killing off the elephants will likely trigger more conflict in the arid lands of northeast Kenya. L, the incidence of wildfires in the cedar forests of Lebanon has increased tremendously over recent years. M, quote, if things go business as usual, we will not live, we will die. That from Maldives President Mohamed Nasheed, telling the UN General Assembly, our country will not exist. N, the ministers of Nepal have held the world's highest cabinet meeting on Mount Everest, as rapidly rising temperatures have reduced snowfall over the mountains and caused glaciers to melt. O, more than 50% of the population of Oman lives on coastlines vulnerable to rising seas, but its supplies of periodontite may help sequester carbon dioxide emissions. P, the massive floods that killed hundreds in the Philippines this summer are becoming the norm. Q, petroleum-soaked Qatar emits 60 tons of carbon dioxide per person, the most of any nation on Earth. R, increased floods and malaria outbreaks from global warming, deforestation, and unsanitary conditions have hit Rwanda hard in the past decade. S, the inhabitants of the alpine villages of Fischertal and Fisch in Switzerland have asked for the Pope to bless their prayers for the restoration of their nation's glaciers, which shrank by 12% over the past decade. Oh, my heavens. T, newly discovered exotic species like the fanged frog of Thailand are especially vulnerable, as climate change will further shrink their already restricted habitats. U, agriculture in the United States has been ravaged this year by catastrophic droughts in Texas and California, heat waves in Louisiana and Nebraska, storms across the high plains in the Midwest, floods in North Dakota and Minnesota, and torrential rains in Illinois and Georgia. V, speaking from Vatican City on the eve of the Copenhagen conference, Pope Benedict XVI counseled, quote, all people of goodwill to respect the laws laid down by God in nature and to rediscover the moral dimension of human life. W, warming oceans and sea level rise threaten the coral reefs of the remote Polynesian islands of Wallace and Futuna. X, the nomadic descendants of Kublai Khan in Inner Mongolia, where Xanadu once stood, are being driven from the grasslands as the Chinese government attempts to fight the region's desertification. Y, Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, may be the first capital city in the world to run out of water as drought and overuse diminish its supply. Z, on the border of Zambia and Zimbabwe, the flow of Victoria Falls is far below average as drought and high temperatures reduce the Zambezi. It's a hell of a list. That's a stunning list. And that's also the end of the second hour of the program. You can chime in, or you can wait for the hissy that I'm probably going to throw after the after our little musical interlude. And, well, then call in. I don't know. Whatever. Look, it's Thursday. It's like any other day on the horn. Whatever is on your mind. Right? Sure. So, you know, crank it up if you want. You know the number, locally or direct dial for those of you that doesn't cost anything, 304-658-3333, or 877-443-2366, 877 the numeral 4, head on. Whatever's on your mind is fine. I'm sorry, I'm not feeling very funny tonight, I guess. But you can chime right in, as pleases you. Email comes in to Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at gmail.com. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. We'll take a little musical interlude and be back. This is The Horn.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
And away we go into the third hour. I've tried to pick my spirits up a little bit. Sorry about that. Not trying to be a persistent bummer. But, well, you know what we'll do? We will do what this show is all about. We will go straightway to the phones. So let's do that. Ah! No patience. Okay, we won't go to the phones. Well, okay. Plan B. There were a couple of things that I had on the agenda for this evening when I started thinking about what this evening's show would be. Of course, chief among them was the hypocrisy of the Nobel acceptance speech. And I'm sure, you know, look, don't get me wrong, okay? I am not anti-Obama. I would like for Barack Obama to be what Barack Obama can be instead of what his political advisors persist in telling him he should be or must be in order to win re-election. What I think, at least in myself, and if I read your emails and your phone calls correctly, what I sense is that we are tired of political timidity, and we are looking for someone out there just once in our lifetimes to do the right thing. Just do the right thing. Courage. A little bit of the same courage that working Americans show every day when they go out and they carry those fraudsters and banksters that Joe Bagent was writing about on their backs. A little of the same courage of the working day is all we ask. And it seems to be the one thing that we may not have. Hey, welcome to the program.
We will go to the phone.
No, we did. We did.
Yeah.
What's up, David?
Well, I don't think we can be surprised by Barack Obama's responses.
Oh, I didn't say I was surprised.
No, I know you, but this is to a lot of people who continue to force it on that we've got to force him to change. We've got to make him change. And I say to those people, I say, look how many people are controlling the strings, control the purse. What do we have to offer other than people in the streets? And we can't even get that. Not to be a bummer, but that's the reality. And it's going to be that reality for some time. And you can blame that on a number of distractions if you want, or you can just blame that on the climate, the time that we're in. You know, there's a lot of different factors you can put the blame on, but, you know, that's the reality we face. And now we have to, and now the floating question mark comes up. So what do you do with that reality? And, we'll figure something out, but it will probably be something that a lot of people, will not move to suddenly. They won't be open to it, and I hate to say it, but we're probably going to experience a rise of madness in this country like we've never seen before. Well, they already have it on Wall Street, so it's only natural we get it too.
What sort of madness?
I mean, you know, everyone talks about depression, Bob, and I was thinking about that and the economy and all of that. But
yeah, okay, you mean economic depression, not biochemical.
Yeah, but I'm talking about, you know, when someone loses their job, the madness of war, the madness of poverty, and when all of this accumulates, I think the promises of the backlog of promises that so many leaders have tried to given us, which I think is really, really dangerous to do. And it seems to be so backlogged now that there's going to be a flood, and nobody really knows what's going to happen. But I don't see bright things for a big majority of this country. That's why I always say there will be bastions of places that will be really amazing places.
What you're describing is everyday life in empire, David. You know, when you live in empire, there are
pockets of profound wealth. When you live in empire, there are pockets of prosperity.
Mm-hmm.
There are pockets of happiness. But the vast majority labors on in ignominy, the propping up empire.
Well, you know, the problem is when we talk about how to offset this and how to fix this and to give people more of their fair share. We're going to run across. I don't know if you were listening to me on John's program Sunday, but what I was saying was, if you guys want to see the real reality, and what I mean by the real reality, is just go to debtcloth.org and just look at all the timers of all the money that we owe everybody.
Debtcloth.org.
Now, why I say this, Bob, is for a number of reasons. It's because the problem is that you said what you often bring up, what does a collapse look like? And a lot of people say that. Well, I would say we're in a fantasy world right now. We are virtually in a fantasy world. And when you look at the debt clock, here's the reality. And this is what I told John for those people who aren't listening. I said, you have a time bomb. You have the red wire, the blue wire, the yellow wire, the green wire, the purple wire, and you can cut as much debt as you want from the war, much debt as you want from anything on everything you can imagine that's negative to our society. But guess what? Still not stopping those clocks. And it's still going astronomical numbers, and there's no way. People have lied to us. People have lied to us to such a degree that it literally is a time bomb. You can't stop. There's no pulling back the debt, people. There's none. It's not going to happen.
And the end result is?
The end result is, I guess in a weird way, if nobody notices, and we just continue to live how we're living, then I guess we can live in a collapse with a virtual hologram like this.
Well, you know, it's what Joe Bagent was referencing.
Yeah.
We can't, this country can't, and God knows the people who are actually supporting this country can't live on credit cards forever.
That's true.
I mean, it's almost impossible to ignore. So I honest to God don't know what the answer is. I'm totally flipping lost. Of course, I've never held myself out as the answer man.
Well, I think.
But you know, is again, all I can go back on is a tired old metaphor that I've used. Nobody's gonna come. There's not gonna be big neon signs that go up saying the party's over.
Right. That's what a lot of people think. Yeah.
But what you're going to see, and you know, it's that function again, referring to what Joe wrote. It's that function of realizing that every day of every year, a certain percentage of unemployed people simply slip off the radar. They just boop, and the blip goes out, and they're forgotten about, and they don't count. You know, hell's bells. I'm one of those people.
Mm-hmm.
I know that there are lots of people inside the Horn audience who are those people. Perfectly capable of work, highly intelligent human beings who haven't had a job that is statistically meaningful to the government of the United States for over a year and therefore simply do not count. And as those people, and again, another, you know, some percentage, it happens to every day. Just like of that 45,000 people a year who die from want of access to basic health care coverage, some of those happen every day. But it's broadly attenuated, David.
Right.
It's so broadly attenuated that we don't see them. And unless we actively think about them, we don't consider them. You know, how many people, and I'm not pointing out you, but how many people on your street have been to Iraq or Afghanistan?
I couldn't tell you.
Right. How many people in your town?
And that's not just you. It's anywhere. You know, there are places, pockets in this country where the horror has come home of these horribly, horribly, horribly misguided decisions to wage wars of choice in far-off Asian lands. But it is so attenuated that no one really notices. You know, you hear about somebody who knew somebody who had a cousin who was over there and got killed. But it's not in your face.
Right.
You know, and that's, yeah, they say that the old saying back in, what, the 60s was the revolution will not be televised. Well, neither will the Great Depression. Neither will the Greater Depression. Neither will the economic collapse of the world's last superpower. No, it won't be televised, David. It will, and God knows nothing will preempt Dancing with the Stars.
That's true.
And nothing will preempt my beloved college football Saturdays. We will simply be entertained into oblivion. Bread and circuses, brother. Bread and circuses.
I hear you, and I think that's part of the reason why a lot of countries are looking around at us and saying it would be best for them to suffer, because we know from past history what happens when we ever let them have a hand in anything ever again. And I think that's part of the problem, is that we've done so much, and I believe I call it karmic redistribution. And that's what I think is happening in this country at an alarming rate. We just never we never knew it was going to come at this type of level, and we had no idea of how it would escalate and which and how it would pile onto us. And I think that's a big problem with this.
Well, you know, and part of it has to do with the shortness of human life, David.
Yeah.
We don't have long vision. You know, we go back and look at history, and it looks like things happen abruptly and change just, you know, boom. But it doesn't. Everything is a gradual process over the course of rising and diminishing generations. The Roman Empire, as I've noted before, never put up a going out of business sign. They just woke up one day that they thought was another normal day, and Attila the Hun was on the gates.
Mm-hmm. I think when we look at someone like Obama, I think he's terrified to tell us the truth, and I'm sure he has
You know, you may be right, David, but I'm not even willing. I'm not willing to do that speculation anymore.
Yeah,
I know, we had the speculation of, you know, maybe he's doing this because he's afraid that those batshit crazy bastards are going to shoot him, and I wouldn't be, if you're the president. Somebody always wants you dead. So that's a legitimate concern, but frankly, it comes with the job. You don't want to deal with it? Don't run for it.
I know, but you know the problem with this though, Bob, is that every time you bring up criticisms of Obama, you know what the answer comes back. It's only been a year. And it's like a parrot. It's only been a year. You can't fix everything in a year. And you start to realize this is the behavior pattern of the majority of the public, and they will continue this on and on after presidency and presidency, because it's ingrained and embedded and indoctrinated into their system of thinking that there has to be that someone has to be the person that they claim to be later on in their second term. And it's beyond sadistic.
Well, you're talking about systemic failures of our form of government.
Yeah.
I think some of the stuff that Sandra was talking about earlier.
Right.
And I think that's certainly part of the problem. But when, as in my conversation with Sandra, when in American history was there not a class of people who were laboring for nothing more than bread and meager shelter to keep this nation going? When wasn't that? Newsflash, it never wasn't.
Yeah, that's
well, that's
true.
Some tormented grammar. So it gets worse, it gets better, and right now we are in a long sliding spiral toward the militaristic oligarchy. To a certain extent, we're already there.
Right.
And so the question becomes, how many people are willing to get off their butts and get out in the streets and work for something different? I'm not talking about carrying a protest sign or marching or turning over mailboxes. I'm talking about work. I'm talking about working with organizations and groups of like-minded people of goodwill that go out there and try to make some sort of a damn difference in some portion of aching humanity's life. And I'm not holding myself up as a model, because right. I am not. But, you know, how many of us are doing it? You know, it's one thing to bitch. It's another to do.
Well, you know, I think the problem with that is that we get motivated when there is an emergency and a physical crisis that we can see and we can feel. We can feel it a bit, but there needs to be something that happens in this country where it just shakes us to our core, if you understand what I'm saying.
Well, supposedly we had one of those on September the 11th, 2001.
Yeah, but we...
And we were just told to go shopping.
Yeah. I'm talking about something bigger.
And fly to Disneyland.
I don't know. Maybe a you know what would do it for this country? I think a gigantic tsunami hitting America. That would do it.
No, we had one of those.
Yeah, but I mean, completely enveloping us.
No, look, please understand, there is a portion of this country that even as our coastal cities drown, will still be screaming from whatever high ground that they can crawl over somebody to get on, that global warming is a fraud and a hoax. You know, it's a modification of that thing that Jesus said, you know, that I keep, the morons you have always with you. No, the only wake up call that I know of that I can even think of, and it's certainly not a sure thing, David.
Yeah.
Is if those miserable bastards, those birthers and deathers and baggers and boogers, get their way.
Well, you know that.
And then it is going to be, and then it is going to be hell among the yearlings.
Well, that goes back to what Alan was saying. Do you continue to vote for the Democratic Party? When do you say, I have had enough of you?
Well, Alan was also talking about registration. And his point was that the only real vote you get is to change your registration and dump both parties.
Right.
If you decide to co-opt out of the elections altogether, that's your business. Or if you support some green or some other third-party candidate, that is equally your choice in the electoral process. But I don't know. I'm in a serious existential crisis, I suppose. I don't know.
I guess we'll soon find out as time marches on, where our political affiliations decide to be in this country. Personally, I don't think the two-tier system.
And how many people want to be? You know, how many people want to be part of it?
Yeah, that's the thing.
Yeah, it's a tough contemplation, David. It really is.
Well.
And you know, at the same time that we sit and we look at how bad things are, it's also good to remember that old saying. You know, some people see things as they are and say, "Why?" I see things as they should be and say, "Why not?" You know, exercises in optimism are always good and valid.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I think, if there's going to be an upside to this, is that somebody constantly has to be thinking about what the real answers are. Because if that day does dawn, and frankly, I think we're tracking toward it, if that day does dawn where the birthers and the baggers and the tenthers and the deathers and you know, the dead from the neck uppers and the know-nothings get their way, then once they have had their way, the rebuilding process will have to begin, and there will have to be somebody there who has the ideas for going forward and can do something more than say, well, they certainly sucked. And I'm not saying I'm that guy.
I don't know who is that person, but I think we all collectively do try to work that good energy in that direction.
Yeah.
Or at least I hope the heck we do. So, you know, I guess that's sort of the position of stasis where perhaps we are. David, it's been a good conversation, but I got to roll along, and we will talk soon.
All right, later.
All right, see you, David. Pop culture correspondent David calling from Maine, and on we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Hey, what's up, Jethro?
What's going on?
It's madness.
Hey, the madness continues. Yeah, this Afghanistan thing, it's, the just war. You know, you say, well, why? You know, it's like being down the corner as a kid. Well, why? You know, just because.
Yeah, you know, when I heard that just war thing, Jethro, you know, the first thing I thought of was the old, and, you know, this just goes to show how twisted my mind works. I was thinking in terms of the old apocryphal story about chess pie. Now, you ever had chess pie? It's, you know, it's kind of like a custard pie. It's real rich. But the old story is that George Washington's cook looked at Mr. Washington and said, what kind of dessert you want tonight? And he said, just pie. But you got to remember, he had those funky wooden teeth, and things didn't come out quite right. And his cook thought she heard chess pie, and she'd never heard of it, of anything of the sort. And she went in and sort of invented it and brought it to him, and he loved it. And it was blah blah blah. And that's what we got about Afghanistan. Well, why are we there? Just war, just war. It's just war.
Yeah, it's the same. Yeah, who is in charge? Obviously. Obama's worried about, becoming a casualty or something? You can't worry about that and do the job. I don't think that's it. The military industrial complex, that is our war, is now our major industry. That and putting people in prison and spying and snooping and
torturing. Don't forget the torturing.
Yes, the renditions and the torturing. Now, that's the American way now.
Yeah.
You know, and being suspicious of anybody that's not marching in line or some Stepford person, if you happen to be taking a photograph somewhere, you're automatically suspicious. Or if you show any signs of intelligence or anything, you know, could you be a terrorist?
Well, you know, let's just war theory, Jethro. Let's run over these real quick. You know, there's four components in order to create a just war, according to paragraph 2309 of the Catechism of the Catholic Church.
you want to talk some madness?
Yeah. Okay. Well. Okay. So here's part one. Let's see if we can make Afghanistan. I mean, we'll work at it, Jethro.
Church is going to have four rules for just war.
They got them. Of course, they got rules for everything, except for how gay people get into heaven, but we won't go there.
Protecting cardinal law.
Yeah, they most certainly have rules for protecting pedophilic priests. But anyway, just for the sake of argument, and we'll work real hard here, Jethro, we will try to shoehorn America's involvement into Afghanistan in every one of these. The first standard is that the damage, okay, this is about the attack. Whatever it is that precipitates the just war, the damage inflicted by the aggressor on the nation or community of nations must be lasting, grave, and certain. Okay, so this would be September the 11th, 2001, because that's why we attacked Afghanistan, right? If you throw out the pipeline that goes from Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan down through Afghanistan and into Pakistan, that's why we went into Afghanistan.
Right, right. I was trying to keep from saying, CIA Mossad link. Anyway, yeah, so, okay, bin Laden got the blame on that. Yeah, he did out of a cave, him and, two or three camels and a couple of goat herders, yeah.
Right. Okay, and the damage inflicted by those guys has to be lasting, grave, and certain. But let's remember, and this is troublesome, Jethro, let's remember that Osama bin Laden was not an Afghan citizen, nor was he an agent of the Afghan government, nor was he an office holder of any sort of Afghan government. He was, you know, a terrorist operating out of a cave with a portable dialysis machine. That's what he was.
Pay no attention to the Saudis behind the curtain.
Bingo. The ones who want no action on climate change in Copenhagen. But the damage that was inflicted on 2001 was lasting, grave, and certain. Well, you know, there's certainly a lasting impact to killing 3,000 people, and it certainly sent them to their graves. But it was grave, and it was ascertainable. Okay, so we've shoehorned Afghanistan into that. Okay, we get to part two, Jethro. Check this out. See if you can work with this. All other means of putting an end to it, that aggression, must have been shown to be impractical or ineffective. When did we even consider any other means?
Yeah, I believe that was called the Bush cowboy diplomacy, wasn't it? You know, jump on your horse, ride into the sunset, shoot anything that, you know.
Well, do remember that the Taliban offered to turn bin Laden over to the International Criminal Court at The Hague. So we have to prove then that that solution, which would have been a solution that would have put an end to it, you know, we're dealing with part two here, that turning bin Laden over for trial in The Hague was either impractical or ineffective.
Well, yeah, and then there was one dead or alive, and then it was, he's not that important, and then we don't hear anything for years, and just, you know, see a few fake videos. But now either McChrystal or Petraeus came out and said, the most important thing about this Afghanistan, we have got to kill bin Laden. And so then Gates...
Even if we have to dig him up and kill him again.
Right, so Gates comes on. Then Gates comes on the next day or something, or same day, a couple hours later, on Meet the Press, and he's saying, well, bin Laden, we haven't had any intelligence reports on him in years. So who's... Yeah, that's, you know, bin Laden, the new Emmanuel Goldstein. You know, the, wasn't that the 1984 guy?
Yeah, that was. Yeah, right.
The eternal, mysterious, you know, all-powerful enemy terrorist leader that they used for propaganda purposes and, you know, going to wars and... And this Afghanistan war, it's the whole deal to set up the pipeline. Yeah, you know, we're doing Israel's bidding. You know, it helps us to get another stranglehold on Iran. We'll have it surrounded now, I think, with Afghanistan and Iraq, Saudi Arabia.
So what we're faced here is that our just war in Afghanistan is failing on criteria two. We're not even to three or four.
I'm sorry. Continue.
No. I mean, I'm not barking at you, but what I'm saying,
I hear you.
We can't get past two. Impractical or ineffective. So what you have to argue, because remember, we're going to shoehorn the United States in, and we're going to make this work, okay? You'd have to argue that killing bin Laden would be either impractical or ineffective. Or that getting bin Laden would somehow not make the attacks stop. Okay, so for the sake of argument, all right. Okay, so then we have to go, and this is the $64 question, Jethro. This is why it was so important that we get past step two, that we sort of dummy up steps one and two so we could get to step three, because this is a lulu. Step three in waging a just war is... There must be some serious prospects of success.
Yeah.
And, you know, and some serious prospect of success presupposes that there's some sort of metric you can apply to it whereby you can say, aha, success!
Well, I think you can apply a historical aspect to the success of invaders in Afghanistan. I mean, it's not known as the, you know, the country that destroys empires for nothing. And actually, I think the only people who were successful in going through there were the Muslims themselves, you know.
And Genghis Khan.
So, And you know, the British tried to go out of there under a flag of retreat. They thought they were, you know, they wouldn't be attacked, but they attacked and tried to kill as many of the British as they could before they got across the border.
But see, one of the things, Jethro, is that we know that we are in a conundrum here, because repeatedly over the course of, dear God, what is it now, more than 8 years, we have constantly we've sort of redefined what success would mean over there.
Oh yeah, we've defined it down. Same thing with Iraq. Is, you know, all this foolishness of establishing democracy and having voting and stuff. Afghanistan's a warlord culture. And, you know, we're not going to change anything there. All they're doing is using us. We're bribing. You know, a lot of people are fooled into thinking that those foreigners over there see that our way is better, and they start making friends with the Americans. That's the furthest thing from the truth. We are over there bribing every official, every person that we can give money to try to get them to be on our side. Same thing we did in Vietnam. If we weren't killing them, we're bribing them. And at night, they come and, you know, attack us wearing the black uniforms. You know, they're Viet Cong at night. Same thing with these guys. We're paying them off. We're paying them off. We're paying all these warlords off to be loyal to us. All they're doing is taking a paycheck, and, you know, if they have to, they'll get us later. But we're supplying weapons. It's unreal, the scope of this deal.
You know, I'm just looking at the Wikipedia page for Just War, and one of the things that it points out is that the importance of just war theory faded with the revival of classical republicanism, beginning with the works of Thomas Hobbes. So even in talking about this angels dancing on a head of a pin theory, what we have to admit in the front end of it, Jethro, is that we are engaged in retrograde motion.
Well, this whole concept of man trying to rationalize just war, it's just, it is a gross, materialistic, with no spiritual insight or no really, you know, it's pretty base. It's just you're overcome with material greed and desire and power and lust and hunger and...
Yeah, and if we can just give them enough Frisbees and wheat checks, they'll love us to pieces. It don't work that way, does it?
We haven't even gotten to Pat Tillman yet.
No, and we haven't gotten to part four. And if you thought part three was a Lulu, wait till you hear part four.
That's okay. I've already picked, so I might be able to take this one.
The use of arms must not produce evils and disorders graver than the evil to be eliminated. I told you it was a doozy. So, in other words, if you are trying to get revenge or retribution against a country that didn't attack you, but somebody inside it did, when you attack the country that didn't attack you, but somebody inside it did, what you do when you attack the country that didn't attack you, what you do in doing that can't be any worse than what they did to you.
Yeah.
So you get, so then we enter onto this moral relativism equivalency scale where we have to argue whether 3,000 Americans and other nationals at the World Trade Center and in the Pentagon and aboard those planes, whether those 3,000 lives being lost, taken, murdered, whether it is worse for us to then go into that country and start, killing wedding parties with Predator drones bearing Hellfire missiles. And I don't think that is, once you get to 3,000 people, party over. We've killed more than 3,000, Afghanis, haven't we, Jethro?
Oh, yeah. The number of civilians we've killed in Afghanistan and Iraq, it's, you know, they've tried to hide that. Some say is, you know, over a million people in Iraq. I don't know if we've killed them all, but they have died as a result of our action. Same thing in Afghanistan. I mean, we haven't got to a million yet, but we're trying really hard. Those Predator drones, we're killing civilians in Pakistan as well with those drones. We've got Blackwater over there, all these mercenary fighters over there. We've got mercenaries in Afghanistan, too, who are, you know, they're like roving gangs in the Civil War. They just come up on a little village or something, and bingo. They kill everybody in there and move on, and nothing. You know? But then they can blame it on a wayward airstrike or something.
And what's accomplished?
Nothing. All we accomplish is somebody hating us. In Afghanistan, you know, they're... And guys over in the Middle East, for them, vengeance is a dish served cold. You know, they have to wait 70, 80 years. That's, you know, that's...
70? What, two generations? That's easy.
Yeah, that's rushing it. So the whole folly of the myth of the United States being the great benefactor and engaging in just war and, you know, make it look like we're doing somebody a favor. You know, can you get any crazier than that? Can you? I mean, and having the people swallow it, that is the sickening part.
Yeah, obviously you did catch the part of the speech where he said, where he basically implied that the world should be grateful to us for going and blowing up brown people, because otherwise they'd have to do it themselves, because God knows nobody wants peace.
Well, I think the world is secretly... behind the scenes, trying to go ahead and knock the supports out from under us. I think the Chinese and some other people are...
Oh, that's been the Chinese game. From the minute that George H.W. Bush and his big brother, who was at the time the head of the U.S.-China Chamber of Commerce, started putting together the ideas of turning the American economy over to the People's Republic of China... From the minute that they did that, they knew that the Chinese knew that the fix was in. You know, and I'm not talking about Chinese laborers or Chinese peasants or people going to work every day in China. I'm talking about governmental policy.
Yeah, and it started before that. It started with Reagan and Pappy Bush and with Clinton. Because when I was at the Mine Academy, they had all these Chinese people over there. That was in the late 80s and early 90s. All these Chinese people over there, we were giving them all of our coal mining technology and who knows what other kind of manufacturing technology, even back then. So, but what they're going to do, you know, they're not going to have to fire a shot on us. All they're going to do is start their own currency.
Just call the note.
And devaluate ours. They're going to get themselves in position where they can change the currency, where they're not going to lose their hind end, too. And then they're going to do it, and then that's going to be us. So.
Yeah, and then it's atonal music, and the six-pack of Budweiser costs $1,200, and maybe then the American people will wake up. But maybe that's also our curse, Jethro, is that we are a somnolent bunch.
Well, we West Virginians start, you know, needing to teach some of these city folks some self-reliance. You know, that garden and that moonshine still, or the... Applejack or the homebrew and the wood-burning stove and on and on. So, you know, that's the way it was during the first Great Depression. People had to go out and, you know, Victory Gardens, that's where they came from.
But I think the fundamental difference between that between then and now is the fact that we didn't have quite as much of an urbanized population. We had people who were living on ground in which they could raise gardens.
Exactly.
And we also hadn't turned under a bunch of our prime farmland for McMansions.
Exactly. Well, I mean, that's what we have to turn back to. And it's going to, you know, it's a law of physics as well. You know, an object will continue in space at the same direction and same rate until acted on from an outside force. And most people, you know, I want my bread, I want my services, I want it now. Somehow that needs to be jarred, and people need to start depending on each other again, and...
Oh, be careful, Jethro, that sounds like socialism. And you know that socialism equals fascism.
Well, you know, and they have made such a big part, you know, back in the 60s, when I was a teenager and stuff, you know, and the 50s, all these bomb shelters and civil defense stuff everywhere, and, you know, learn to hide down under your desk. The commies are going to get us. Well, now it's the socialists who are going to get us. The socialists and the
socialist fascists.
Yeah, Muslims.
Socialist, fascist, Muslim, Al-Qaeda members.
Terrorists, yeah. So, yeah, and it's got everybody all riled up and scared and...
Well, you know, I loved that one comment from Joe Bajant earlier where he said, the American people haven't quite yet glommed onto the notion that, oddly enough, all of our terrorists seem to live next to oil and natural gas deposits.
I hear you. And I don't know, maybe we need a jolt, and like one of the previous caller was this karma thing. Is it going to take something major like that for people to start being able to rely on each other and to trust each other and, you know, for some kind of common good, which would be, you know, getting enough to eat and surviving the winter? I hope it doesn't come to that, but it seems like things are in motion now. I don't know. I don't feel good about the whole situation. I'm not saying it's going to be any survival thing like the road, but I do believe our standard of living is going down, and we're going to have to start raising some of our own food and kind of getting back to the land.
And, you know, absolutely, Jethro, because, you know, it went back, it goes way back to the on-air days in Beckley, if you remember, when that story first came out, I guess, in 2004, that for the first time in like 60 years, the United States had become a net importer of food instead of a net exporter of food. We import, and anybody paying attention should read this with real concern. We import more food than we grow.
And that was another thing back in the 60s, you know, another American great number one. We were supposedly the breadbasket of the world. So, you know, we've over-farmed, we've over-fertilized. We haven't been good stewards. We haven't done anything organic. It's all been the quick buck, you know, the easy fix method. Now it's all AgriCorp. And the more AgriCorp you get, the less human you get.
Right. And one of the reasons that we are a net importer of food, I think, is because so much American farmland has been turned toward the cultivation of what is called number two field grade corn, otherwise known as Roundup Ready corn, otherwise known as Monsanto's Franken corn, which is the corn that you use in that bizarre fracturing process that yields high fructose corn syrup that just happens to be burning the pancreases up of an entire nation.
Poison. I think Bayer just had to pay a couple of $1 million because they admitted that their GMO crops, they could not control them, and they couldn't keep them from contaminating other farmers' crops. So that's going to be another ecological, environmental disaster in its own right. You know, people need to get back to using heirloom seeds and none of this hybrid stuff with their tomatoes. Some say that, you know, if some of these newer tomato varieties have pig genetics in them. I even heard that data.
And one of the best entries into understanding all of this is Michael Pollan's book, The Anatomy of the Something of Desire. It's not The Anatomy, but anyway, he has a chapter on Frankenfoods. And yes, there is an enzyme that was spliced into the Frankenspud that this gene came from the stomach of a goat.
Wow.
And, you know, I mean, it's not speculative or anything. It really did. And they were all set to hustle this to McDonald's and Wendy's and Burger King until there was enough of a hue and cry that Wendy's and McDonald's and Burger King realized that they weren't going to sell any French fries if they did that.
Right. The omnivore's dilemma, is that what?
No, the omnivore's dilemma is what came later. It's not the anatomy of desire. But it's something of desire, and it came out before omnivore's dilemma.
I hear you, but that's great. I mean, you are what you eat.
Yeah, and nobody wanted to be part of a goat stomach because what it was a genetic enzyme producer that when a potato bug, and anybody who's ever been around a garden in West Virginia or anywhere else has seen a potato bug, they're just hateful, obnoxious little beasts. when the potato bug bit the potato leaf, the enzyme from the goat's stomach that was spliced into the frankenspud would immediately kill the potato bug. I don't want that floating around in me.
Right, right. Well, I think with some of the corn, too, they killed the bugs, but it also killed all the butterflies and all these other beneficial insects and stuff.
Well, yeah, and that's the same, you know, that's the same thing with Roundup. It kills indiscriminately with the exception of the GMO corn that has a gene spliced in it to keep the Roundup from killing it.
Right. Well, I think the Roundup, they were trying to contribute some of this Roundup stuff with the bee decline as well. I'm not sure if they have.
Well, and it's another Bayer poison too.
Yeah.
Bayer was big in the bee colony collapse. But like with the corn business, the thing is that number two field grade corn, you know, everybody the garden season, there's nothing better than going out to the garden and ripping a few ears off the stalks and coming in and shucking them and getting all the silk off of them and putting them in the boiling water and having fresh corn on the cob with some sweet butter and salt, right? Good stuff. Well, you could take that number. Then this is the just horrifying part, because it's not food. You can take that number two field grade corn and you can boil it for a month of Sundays, Jethro, and you, human being Jethro, can't eat it ever at all. It cannot be consumed by a human unless it has been subjected to some torturous chemical process that results in it being high fructose corn sweetener, or else it gets fed to a cow, and then, you know, Katie bar the door, because the cow's standing on the CAFO feedlot up to its knees in its own caca, getting jacked up with hormones and antibiotics because it's eating stuff it's not supposed to be eating in the first place, and anybody want a hamburger?
Madness,
Jethro, madness.
I mean, yeah, if you know, just the few brief subjects we've covered in our discussion here, that's enough to drive you crazy right there if you really think about it too much.
These 3 hours are the only way I can get from day to day, Jethro.
Right. I can tell you they're not spraying any poison on those opium poppies over in Afghanistan.
Oh, no.
That's one of the reasons they killed Tillman, because he was reporting that they had troops guarding the opium fields 24/7. And to me, that's what got the... And he was starting to speak out against it as the hopeless back then. I really think that he was taken out. He was they decided he was expendable because he was talking too much. He wasn't going along with the mission.
Well, or he saw that the mission was BS, right?
Oh, yeah, he knew it was BS. That's what got him killed. Him speaking out saying it was BS. One of those other guys were all gung-ho and, you know, ready to kill somebody, I guess, including Tillman, if they got in the way. And that's what this whole deal in Afghanistan, you know, we're doing the bidding of Israel, and we're trying to get those pipelines, and we're going to try to control Iraq, and the whole deal's going to fall in on itself. It's just a matter of time.
And we are going to be in a sorry, sorry mess when it does, Jethro. It is indeed...
Madness.
Jethro, wonderful conversation. I hope we talk soon.
Sure enough.
All right. Later, brother.
All right, Bob. Thank you.
Bye now. Oh, this is just wonderful hearing from Jethro. It's like being in the Wayback Machine, and it is madness. It is absolute, sheer, unadulterated, 200-proof madness. It's also time to roll on out of here. It's Malloy time. Right? Right. Maybe Malloy will be more fun than I was tonight, for God's sakes. I hope so. That's where I'm going. At any rate, thanks, everybody, for being here. And for sharing your thoughts, your ideas, your phone calls, your emails, chatting in the chat room, the whole enchilada, as they say. Thanks to those who have stepped up and contributed to the Horn's ongoing efforts at survival. It just gets weirder and just gets harder, but we are so, so grateful for those of you who do step up. We'll be back at it tomorrow for Friday on the Front Porch. Looking forward to that. Thanks to John Fox, to Peter Godbold, to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org,
All these people contributing so much to making the horn happen. Thanks to our moderators in the chat room, to our blogger, Texas Betsy, to our news ninjas, Susan and Jean, to Sue, to Lottie, everyone, thank you, thank you. There are still a few, for the love of West Virginia, prints left. Many thanks continue to go out to our dear friend Diane, who created those. If you don't have one yet, you really need one. They are of extremely limited vintage, so to speak. And when they're gone, they're just gone. And they are going. So click the link and get one if you want. And I should mention, by the way, that Diane originally said she was going to keep 25% of the proceeds. No, no. She changed that a long time ago. 100% of the proceeds of the sale go strictly to keeping the horn on the air. So thank you to Diane. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ColeRiverWind.org. I have a story about wind in West Virginia I did not get to this evening. I think you're going to be horrified and sickened when you do. I'll try to make sure that we get to that on the front porch, if that's okay, tomorrow night. But the fact of the matter is, they are, Coal River Mountain Watch, the hardest working, bravest people I know. And when you find out what's being done to put the shiv in the back of what we're trying to do with the wind project, you're going to howl. But we'll do that tomorrow. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
With America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Officially winter, at least around here. Our roof survived the winds, but I am, as of this evening, no longer able, and probably not able until May, to do the show naked. Because, you know, that's how we do the program, naked. Yeah. But it's just way too cold in the studio here, and I don't want to run the power bill up so we don't have any heat going yet. Just sort of warming myself off the heat coming from the computers. Yeah, that's it. So, I don't know. No naked radio until well past Groundhog Day. Don't even do the visual. It's not worth it. It's just awful. Just awful. It's Thursday. Some portion of me, for reasons I don't fully understand, thinks it's Friday, but it isn't. It's Thursday.
So we've got tonight and tomorrow night some fine conversation going on, I hope. And, you know, this is one of those nights that I'm glad I've got. I'm glad I've got this show. Because I've just got to get some stuff out of my system, and I will do everything in my power not to scream too much. But there's plenty to be frustrated about. I don't know about you. I don't know if you watched the Nobel acceptance speech or have read the transcript. But you know what? there's a lot in that speech not to love. Our president does give good speech. He is so far removed from the stumblings and bumblings and oafish babblings of that moron, jug-eared, pig-eyed idiot who inhabited the White House for the last 8 years, that you at least have to respect that, I guess. But still, that speech. Sweet Jesus, that speech. I'm not going to read it all. But it involved a discussion of what just war is. But there were some lines that leaped out at me. But perhaps the most profound issue surrounding my receipt of this prize is the fact that I am the commander-in-chief of a nation in the midst of two wars. One of these wars is winding down. How's that winding down working out for you there, President Obama? Did you see the report of all the death and carnage from that bomb blast that went off yesterday? That's some winding down, all right. The other is a conflict that America did not seek, one in which we are joined by 43 other countries, including Norway, in an effort to defend ourselves and all nations from further attacks. No mention in there that both of them are wars of choice. You know, it was a week ago tonight, in fact, that Reverbo and I did the whole history thing, sort of going over why it is we're in Afghanistan and how Afghanistan came to be Afghanistan in our sort of little modern world. And no mention in that those were wars of choice that were forced upon the American people and were not wars of necessity. You know, he goes on and he discusses this thing about just war, the concept of just war. And I don't know. I don't know if just war is something we need to be talking about in the 21st century. Perhaps we need to be talking about necessary war. Because there's no way that you can call Iraq or Afghanistan a war of necessity. They were wars of choice. These questions are not new. War, in one form or another, appeared with the first man. At the dawn of history, its morality was not questioned. It was simply a fact, like drought or disease, the manner in which tribes and then civilizations sought power and settled their differences. Yeah, I know my Obama's not quite up to snuff yet. I'm still working on it. I'll have him down by the end of his term. His one term. Sweet Jesus, President Palin. Oh, God. And so he gives a little history lesson, with including, of course, the concept of just war. And then he talks about how nifty it is that we are the world's sole superpower. And then says we must begin by acknowledging the hard truth that we will not eradicate violent conflict in our lifetimes. Well, no, we won't. Once you've decided that you won't, you ain't gonna. How's that? Are we square? And then. Then he invokes the name of Dr. King. I make this statement mindful of what Martin Luther King said in this same ceremony years ago. Violence never brings permanent peace. It solves no social problem. It merely creates new and more complicated ones. As someone who stands here as a direct consequence of Dr. King's life's work, I am living testimony to the moral force of nonviolence. I know there is nothing weak, nothing passive, nothing naive in the creed and lives of Gandhi and King. But as head of state, sworn to protect and defend my nation, time out. I think he's sworn to protect and defend the Constitution. Check me on that. I could be wrong, and it wouldn't be the first time, and it won't be the last. But check that oath for me. Isn't it protect and defend the Constitution of the United States? Make no mistake, evil does exist in the world. A nonviolent movement could not have halted Hitler's armies. Well, he also mentions the League of Nations, which was shot down by a bunch of punk-ass Republicans in the latter part of the second and early part of the third decade of the 20th century. And that